Coming to you live from beautiful Norwalk, Connecticut. I'm Mike DePalma alongside my co-host Danny Santarella. Tony D's behind the glass. Neil hasn't joined us in a while. This time he's got a legitimate excuse. He had some sort of knee surgery.
Yeah.
So he said he's on some pain pills tonight, so he might not be a great addition. But maybe he'll call in.
Is he doing physical comedy?
I don't know.
What is he?
He has something with a flag football game from like 4 years ago. I don't know if he just... He waited for Obamacare to kick in before he could have this surgery or what, dude?
I'm so disappointed.
We need to get him some insurance, I think.
Yeah, we need to do something. We need to get him on the show. Don't worry about insurance.
Was just wobbling around for 4 years on a bum knee.
He's got an ACL, right?
He had major like reconstructive surgery on his knee. Well, Godspeed there, Neil. Hopefully, you're on the mend. But we got a good show for you tonight. As I'm sure you've seen on our Facebook page, we got Jerry Rice calling in a little later on, which will be great. We've got Major League Opening Day, official stateside opening day coming up this weekend, so we'll get to a lot of that. We've got a lot of storylines in the NFL. The Sanchez going over to Philadelphia. That's probably the biggest
story
in the world.
In the country.
But obviously, all the stuff that's going on up in Buffalo. But we'll start out with the NCAA tournament.
Okay.
Obviously, it's they had the picture of Warren Buffett laughing because everybody was gone by, two games into Friday's games. That nobody had a perfect bracket. Although some guy is perfect. Did you see that story?
No.
Some guy.
Not me.
Was in some free. He got in one tournament. It was like some free work thing, but it's online, so they could search the internet for whatever perfect brackets. And he's got a perfect bracket. He didn't enter it in the $1 billion thing, and now he's trying to contact Quicken Loan and all this to like work out some sort of deal.
No.
Like what? In what world would this people be like? Oh, what do we got? $1 billion in the right? Come on in, boss.
Yeah.
Oh, you got the hard part out of the way.
Where do you even get the stone to write
Did
that
email? Did
you
just call up Quicken Loans like 1-800 number? Can I speak with Warren Buffett?
No,
this is Joe Schmo with the perfect bracket.
I didn't see this, and I got to tell you, I was listening the other day when Reggie Miller was doing one of the college games, and he was talking about it. He goes, "It's impossible," and I agree with him. I go, "It is impossible." I mean, I was telling a buddy of mine that if you got to see the score of every single game in the tournament with a minute to go and then make your pick,
you still wouldn't be perfect.
And I guarantee you, with the way all these games have gone, they've been low scoring, they've been close. I don't think you or I or Tony or anybody else could have picked a perfect sheet if we had the score with a minute to go.
Yeah.
I really don't.
Yeah, I agree with you.
That's impressive.
Yeah.
And it's a lot of luck.
This guy didn't know what was going on. If he knew anything, he would at least get in the $1 billion thing. I mean, that's one of those things, if they keep doing that, even though the odds are 1 in 9...
Yeah.
Quadrillion or whatever it is, you got to do it because God forbid you're ever in that situation. How much would you be kicking yourself? And this guy thinks he's going to just call up Warren and be like, "Come on, just let me in. Get me in for $100 million."
The point
of it is to promote whatever they're promoting,
right.
Quicken Loans. So you have to go and sign up, give your email address and all that stuff. Like that's the point of it. They're not doing it for charity.
Yeah.
Like all these things are tied to something.
Yeah. I'm gonna tell you this just to give you a little insight into my March Madness experience so far.
Mm-hmm.
Sunday, I watch KU lose to Stanford.
Yeah.
I was fine. I've been through enough.
Well, you said you didn't think that. You told the audience last week.
16 at best, I thought. But I've been through enough things in life to realize that it's just basketball. You know what I mean? So
yeah.
I got over it. But then I'm going, you know what? I flip over to WGN. That's the Cubs network that I get. And, let me watch the Cubbies a little bit. The second at-bat I see is, I believe they were playing Oakland, is an Oakland lazy fly ball to left field. Darnell McDonald backpedaling. You're not supposed to backpedal.
No, that's what you learn early on.
Absolutely. He's backpedaling, and he catches his back cleat on the cutoff to the warning track, and the ball dropped in. And that was when I said to myself, basketball season's over, and I have 6 months of this ahead. That's what I'm dealing with.
I can't. When we talked about baseball, I think there is a lot of upside to that Cubs team.
I can't wait to hear it. I want to hear about Baez.
We got Baez.
Tell me how Starlin's going to start hustling.
Yeah.
But let's
talk about the
I want to.
So my first, just like an overall bird's eye view of it.
Yeah.
Obviously, had a million of these upsets throughout the whole thing, and on day one, it's great. As the tournament goes on, and now you're sitting there, there's an 11-10 game, and you get diminishing returns clearly on these Cinderella stories when you're looking at all of the big teams that everybody was following, like
right.
Syracuse, Wichita State, those things. Does that make this weekend a little less exciting?
For you, as
a big-time college.
No, and you know what it is? I mean, I look at a game, and I think the one a lot of people are pointing to is they're talking about the Dayton-Stanford game. Being that one of those teams is going to go on, obviously one of them is going to win and play the winner of the Florida-UCLA game, I see it as we make these big stinks about like the 83 NC State team, George Mason, VCU, everybody was kind of pulling for Wichita a little bit to make these runs. And now what you really have here is two legit Cinderellas. Johnny Dawkins was on the verge of getting fired at Stanford 2 months ago. People were calling for his head. Archie Miller has kind of come under the radar. He's the little brother of Sean Miller, the Arizona coach. He's under the radar, and I think it's great for college basketball when you're going to have one of those two teams at some point 40 minutes away from a shot at upsetting Florida, UCLA to go to the Final Four.
Yeah.
It doesn't get cooler than that.
Yeah, that is exciting.
It really doesn't. The only time it really stinks is when it's your favorite team that gets knocked out. And for UConn fans, it won't be that case this year because you're drawing an Iowa State team that's good. So if you guys get knocked out,
yeah,
you lost to a good team. For Kansas, like you lost to Stanford. You were laying like 7 points. How the hell did you lose that game? But the matchup that it leads to with Dayton and Stanford, I like. And I like all the matches. I think all the matches are interesting in their own little ways. And I don't think those runs, like George Mason getting to the Final Four, remember they beat UConn in the Elite Eight?
I remember it, yeah.
Remember that, though? It's, for me, not being a Connecticut fan, how cool is that? Like, look at this team. That's Jim Larrinaga. He's the head coach of Miami now. They just beat UConn, who is a billion times better than them. I think they were laying like 11 points in that game.
Yeah.
And they're just going to the Final Four.
Yeah.
It's awesome. I can't understand the people that complain that it's going to water down the Final Four. Like, who's going to get there? Some, like, JUCO team that stinks?
Yeah,
like,
I
know. They're all going to be
good
teams.
Yeah, it is
going to
be exciting. Yeah, I agree with you. Now, obviously, I came on here and picked Wichita State to win the national championship, which obviously they're not going to do, but... And I told you my reasoning behind it, just because I wanted to shut up the idiots that said they had to have lost the game. Now, watching that game, they didn't play. It's not like all of a sudden they just choked under the pressure. They didn't play poorly at all. It's just all of a sudden Kentucky realized, like, oh, my God, we're actually really, really good, and we should have been doing this all season long. That's the sense I got. I didn't watch a ton of Kentucky, but I know that they got, obviously, every year they get the best recruiting class, and all of a sudden, talent-wise, they were going to be more talented than Wichita State. And they just outplayed him. It wasn't that Wichita State came up there under the big spotlight and choked. Did you get that sense?
No. What I saw in that game really was a Kentucky team that's young, and I've heard a lot of people mentioning how these young teams are losing to veteran teams. Like, you saw a really super talented Duke team, speaking of those, you know, teams we picked to win the championship. What you're realizing now in hindsight, which is perfect 2020, was how young Duke is. And this Mercer team of juniors and seniors comes along and just outplayed them. And Coach Krzyzewski admitted, they just outplayed us. I think what you're seeing with Kentucky is, and I've never been on Calipari's bandwagon in terms of being a great coach in terms of strategy and things like that. He had a perfect game plan for that Wichita team, which was get the game going up-tempo, which Wichita does, get into their depth players, which might not be as talented across the board as Kentucky's. And he used 10 and 11 guys to just slowly cut through that Wichita team and expose their weaknesses, because at the three spots where Wichita's really good, Kentucky's really good.
Yeah.
And what I hate about the aftermath of that is people telling me that Wichita's not good.
Yeah,
and
that's
I said to everybody last week, you couldn't have given them a tougher draw.
Yeah.
Because even if they drew K-State, had K-State beaten Kentucky, that's an in-game rivalry now where K-State said, we're not losing to these little punks. We're going to play as hard as we can. And then, you know, you get through and then you go, there's Louisville. I mean, they couldn't have given Wichita a tougher bracket. It's so stupid to me, anybody that's going to mention Wichita as being a bad team now. Or like we talked about, Francesa saying they should have lost the game. No. Because had they lost to Drake or Missouri State or Indiana State, people would have said they stunk 3 weeks ago. So, you know, they lost to a good Kentucky team that's young. Randall played well.
They didn't get run out of the building.
They played really well.
And it's not like they, you know, came down the stretch and were missing a million foul shots or whatever.
Right.
Speaking of that, I mean, the team other than UConn and Wichita State, because I obviously picked them, that I was rooting for, based just on the fact that we talked to our boy Derek Wittenberg last week, was North Carolina State. And you know, you and I were texting a little bit back and forth about that game, and I was following it mostly on my phone and then happened to turn it on. They're up, what, 14, 5 minutes to go? And that's a team where they just, I mean, they were 13 of 28 from the line for the game.
Yeah.
You're not going to win a lot of big-time games like that. And it was a team that had gone on this great run to get where they needed to be and to be up 14 with 5 minutes to go on the verge of this upset. And that's a heartbreaking loss. Like, that's one of those ones. If Wichita State had done that, then all those critics could say whatever they want about. But that's not how that game played out.
No, and the thing about that game was, I think at one point in the second half, they were 2 of 10 from the line. Just on 10 isolated free throws. And when you're trying to salt away a lead, and you got to give credit to Coach Cruz in St. Louis, they started fouling early.
Mm-hmm.
They said, you know what, we're just going to keep sending these guys the line. He started fouling, I think, at like the 3.5 minute mark. And next thing you know, 12 went to 9, and 9 went to 6. Next thing you know, Jet, the real good player for St. Louis, him and Evans were driving down the court making layups. And you just saw a game where Coach Wittenberg, Coach Gottfried had to be sick to their stomachs.
Yeah.
Because that was one that, unlike some of the other big teams like Duke and Kansas that just got outplayed, they were an underdog team, a few points, that really should have won that ball game. You know, and mm-hmm. that's, we've all been there in, you know, athletics and different things where you let those games slip away. They stay with you if it's a friggin' pickup softball game, you know what I mean? Let alone yeah. you're on the grand stage
oh, yeah.
of March Madness. And,
they'll stick with you in a pickup game at Ben
yeah.
Franklin.
Absolutely.
If you come down the line like that. So let's get to UConn. I had UConn going to the Elite Eight because
yep.
I'm a homer. And I sat there and talked to you about, I always worry about teams that kind of rely on shooting and don't have that go-to big man. But you look at, like, what, you know, Napier, he had that injury. It looked like he was ready to die on the
yeah.
sideline at one point. And then he's back in the game slicing and dicing. And then he's back out with dice on his leg. But you have him. You've got Boatwright. I mean, now they've got Iowa State. It's a 1.5-point spread there. So it's basically a pick'em game between those two teams. What do you give UConn's chances to go on and move on to the Elite Eight at least?
Well, you had them to get to the Elite Eight. I had Iowa State to get to the Elite Eight.
So we had the same game. You
yeah,
had UConn get
I had
Sweet
UConn get
yeah.
the Sweet 16 playing Iowa State, and I had Iowa State to win. I still like Iowa State. My UConn hatred is gone with Calhoun, who didn't sign an autograph for me. I like Ollie. I think the real interesting thing here, which is going to be kind of cool, is you have two coaches coaching at their alma mater that both had solid NBA careers with Fred Hoiberg and Kevin Ollie.
The mayor.
It's a cool story to me. I root against Iowa State all the time in the Big 12, but I find myself rooting for them now. I don't know why that is. I'm rooting for them in Baylor to kind of stand up for the conference when the big dogs like Kansas and Oklahoma and those higher-seeded teams fell. UConn catches a break. George Niang, really good, versatile big guy for Iowa State, broke his foot in their first game. He's a guy that could take a guy like DeAndre Daniels or Niles Giffey and take them away from the hoop, and he's a real good ball handler. But I like Iowa State simply for this reason. Even without Niang, they just played a really good North Carolina team, beat them. I like DeAndre Kane for being the best point guard, I think, on the court. And I told a UConn friend this the other day via text, told me I'm out of my mind, and I said, well, I've only seen Kane play like 15 times. So I'm basing it on that. He's bigger than Napier is. He's lightning fast. He's a really good shooter. They have guys like Nas Long who can move a kid like Boatwright around with little guy like him. Nas Long's pretty big, shoots threes well. They got good guys inside. I think it'll be a really close game around that 1.5 points, but I do like Iowa State. When it comes down to it, I think they're depth. They got a kid named Hogue inside who's kind of like a DeAndre Daniels. All the matchups, to me, favor them, and if they had Niang, I would be confident as hell that they would just beat UConn by 7 or 8.
So what do you think kind of advantage UConn is going to gain or not gain from playing at the Garden? I mean, I've heard that the secondary market for these tickets are like $500, $600
yeah.
a pop for nosebleed seats because it's basically a home game for UConn. What do you mean? I mean, do you think if it was at a truly neutral site, you would get a spread bigger than the 1.5? Do you think that moved the spread being there?
You know, it could. It could move the spread there. I think we've seen, obviously, the Kemba Walker teams and things like that make these unbelievable runs. But at the end of the day, I think when you take an Iowa State team that's played well in places like Allen Fieldhouse or the Lloyd Noble Center or Bramlage Coliseum in the Big 12, places like that, Iowa State's a pretty good team away from Hilton Coliseum. And I think Fred Hoiberg just has a handle on that team in terms of, this is how we play everywhere we go.
Yeah.
Fred Hoiberg's teams don't change. You see a lot of teams, good teams, that change depending on where they're playing. They spread the floor. They'll shoot 30 to 35 three-pointers. They're really good at isolating the matchup advantages they have, which I think you'll see some of DeAndre Kane on the block if UConn plays man. But, yeah, the Garden will certainly probably help them. I can't see it not. Like I said, a lot of experience in the Big East tournament over the years. They made the great run a few years ago. But you got to remember, too, these are a lot of different players now.
Oh, yeah.
You know what I mean? They just played their conference tournament where? Where the hell did they play the AAC tournament? In Nashville or something?
Yeah, yeah.
You know what I mean? So I think the Garden will be a little bit helpful to them. But I think Iowa State is a complete team, even without Niang, that they come in and beat this UConn team, I think, by like maybe 3 or 4.
Okay.
I think it'll be close, though.
Yeah, I think it's going to be – I mean – as a selfish UConn fan, I mean, that, to me, that's the most exciting game, obviously. But what other of the Sweet 16 games? You mentioned the 10-11 game being something you're actually very interested in, even though people are kind of poo-pooing it. What's the other game? Is it Kentucky-Louisville?
Well, that's exciting, obviously,
that's
for the rivalry.
That's got the sizzle, yeah, to it.
I'll tell you the thing I really want to see is, to stay with the Big 12 for a sec, is the Baylor-Wisconsin game. Baylor's a team that I told someone going into the Big 12 tournament, I go, I think they got a really good shot of winning this thing. And they came into that tournament at 9-9 in conference play. Everything was wrong, it seemed. Scott Drew goes to this 2-3 zone towards the end of the season, gets them going a little bit. Wisconsin is just a slow team. They should have lost to Oregon if Dana Altman did a couple things correctly down the stretch. They would have lost to Oregon.
Yeah.
You bring in a Baylor team now that's going to play this 2-3. Isaiah Austin, the big kid in the middle, is legit. He's the kid, I don't know if you've heard the story about him, he's got a prosthetic eye, he's completely blind in his right eye. He's just unbelievable. He's got the moves, he shoots threes, he's 7'5". This Kaminsky kid for Wisconsin that everybody's saying now, he's like the second coming of Jabbar. To me, it's like, I don't see that. I see Baylor being long, athletic, Corey Jefferson's really good. That's the matchup that I'm most interested to see, is the slowdown tempo of Wisconsin versus a long, athletic, get the ball up and down the court team like Baylor.
Mm-hmm.
And then, like you said, the Kentucky-Louisville game should be a big one. You have a guy like Patino, which a lot of people forget, he's won a national title at both of those schools. Now, that'd be like winning one at like Army and Navy or Alabama and Auburn. I mean, it's that big of a rivalry. But I do like Louisville in that game. I think Louisville has some of the veteran presence. I love the Harrell kid inside for them, Montrezl Harrell. But this Julius Randle kid for Kentucky is just continues to make a name for himself.
Yeah.
He came in as a hot prospect. He just keeps getting better and better and better. And you got to tip your cap. Like for me, a guy that's killed on Calipari in the past, I got to give my credit to Calipari there. He's doing a great job with these young guys. You know.
And I mentioned that last week, I don't know if I picked him out in particular, but we talked about the blend between the importance of recruiting and in-game coaching and coaching, outside of the games and practice and stuff. And I kind of downplayed his ability. But then, like you mentioned, his ability to coach in that Wichita State game is what won them that game, I think.
I agree with you. And I consistently go back to the 08 championship game when he was at Memphis and they threw away like an 11-point lead with 3 minutes to go against Kansas. I've always said that if you get out-coached by Bill Self, I mean, that's not good. Alarm bells should start going off.
Yeah.
And he did. But then he comes over, he takes the Kentucky job, and he's obviously got a national championship when he beat Kansas in 2012. He's got this team, when you look at a kid like Randle, he's got the Harrison twins, he's got the Cauley Stein on the inside. None of these guys seem to do all the right things, but they're so athletic. And they play so smart together that even their mistakes, they overcome them by just being just better. They jump higher. They shoot better. You know what I mean? Like I said, you're seeing a freshman and sophomore-laden team
Bunch of pros making decisions.
Yeah. And they're making decisions because they're smart, and I think they're smart because of Calipari. And I never said that before.
Yeah.
I think this might be his best coaching job.
As far as I can remember, I can never remember an 8 seed that legitimately, they make it to the Final Four, it's not even going to be a story.
No.
There won't even be a storyline. In any other year, you get an 8 seed making a run, you know, the way they're making a run and knocking off an undefeated team. It's just that they're Kentucky and they're the big name, and they were preseason number one, I believe.
Yeah.
So it's just kind of weird. It would be a weird path to the Final Four the way Kentucky's done it. I don't know that I've ever seen it being done as a team that, you know, didn't live up to any of the hype. There were times when you're like, are they going to make the tournament? And then they get in, they win a couple games, all of a sudden, you know, couple tough games. You know, you play K-State, and then you play Wichita State, and then they play Louisville, they win this game. It'd be a very weird path for a team to get to the Final Four. I don't know if I've ever seen anything like it.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting to me because I remember it was back in 95 when Arkansas played Duke in the finals, and everybody was kind of lauding Duke and saying Duke's going to win, and when the reason they gave was they're the smarter team.
Yeah.
And I always hated that argument. I've heard the great Nolan Richardson, the Arkansas coach, talk about that, saying how smart do you need to be to shoot a jump shot.
Was that the Corliss Williamson, Scotty Thurman team?
Absolutely, yeah, that was that team. And the reason that I've been critical of the Kentucky team, just, you know, in my own mind watching them as the season went on, was because they were making stupid decisions. And they're not stupid decisions because of who the kids are.
Yeah.
They're stupid decisions because of how young they are, and you're playing just a litany of them, and so you're going to get these dumb decisions. And what I've seen now, watching them play K-State and watching them beat Wichita, is a really smart, young team.
Mm-hmm.
And those are not common. You see a lot of young teams like Kansas throw away a game against Stanford.
Yeah.
You see a young team like Duke get outplayed by Mercer. Calipari has this team beating a really good K-State team, as you mentioned, and Wichita, by making good decisions. Finally, I think the big blue nation out there in Kentucky would say, finally. Like, finally, the Harrison twins, who were such good players, are becoming great players by playing smart.
Yeah.
And now you just take Randall, who's got this otherworldly ability, and he's just floating around going, this is how good I am.
Yeah,
I'm just going to make this shot and drive by this guy. And Anthony Early from Wichita, just he can't guard me. He might be a senior and 4 years old. He just can't guard me.
Yeah.
And they're smart. They're not turning the ball over as much as they were in SEC play. They're dangerous. I would not be surprised at all if they beat Louisville.
Yeah.
If they beat them by 10, it wouldn't surprise me. But that is going to be an interesting game. And I wish the best of luck to all you Connecticut fans. I'm a big fan of Kevin Ollie.
Yeah.
Like seeing what they're doing, so it's going to be fun.
Yeah, I think it is exciting. And it's not one of those years for me where maybe it is just because of UConn, even though my bracket's not necessarily completely busted. You know, even with the losing the national champion, I could still sneak in because a lot of people have already lost. You know, so you never know. One of these teams goes on a run, Kentucky goes on a run, knocks out Louisville, I'm right back in this. You know what I'm saying?
Absolutely.
So, it's definitely going to be exciting. We'll get to our picks later on in the show. We'll tease that a little bit.
All right.
We're going to take a quick break. One more thing I want to mention. One of our sponsors, D'Amato Landscaping, they've offered 10% off spring cleanups. Guy does a great job, Brian, over there, and we'll get you his contact information. For anybody who listens to the show, we're going to give you a keyword later on in the show. You call up Brian, you email him, we're going to give you all that information, and you let him know the keyword, 10% off your spring cleanups. Anywhere in Fairfield County, that's not bad.
Can we make the keywords Bill Self?
Maybe that will be our keyword. We're going to tease that one, too. All right, we're going to take a quick break. We'll be right back. The Tri-State Sports Guys.
Is anyone out there? This is the Nathaniel County Sheriff's Office. Is anyone out there? We were surrounded by the dead. They were in rioters, we were told. We have survivors here. Civilians, women, children. Is anyone out there?
Follow the story in the Ragnarok Rising Saga by D.A. Roberts. Available on Amazon, Smashwords, Barnes & Noble, and BooksAMillion.com. Visit RagnarokRising.weebly.com.
All right, we're back. Tri-State Sports Guys. Number to call is always 347-637-2306. Check us out on our website, TriStateSportsGuys.com, on Facebook, Facebook.com/TriStateSportsGuys, or on Twitter, TriState_Sports. Let's get to some baseball, finally. I mean, I wanted to do like a real when me and O used to do the show, we were very baseball heavy, and you've just completely just taken over the show with your hockey and college sports and all the rest. And it's great. I mean, our numbers have never been better, but we used to really lay it out. We'd spend a half an hour on the NL Central getting into sleepers and blah, blah, blah. We're clearly not going to have time to do any of that. But I did want to talk about this baseball season coming up. We had the games in Australia this past weekend. I have a hunch that's not something you're a fan of, and I'm not going to say I'm not super against the whole idea of all this. I think the detractors from it make way too big of a deal of it, but I also don't like – I like the idea of an opening day where you're, like, super excited. I think they've even taken away from it with all – like, they always have the one game on a Sunday night, and then Monday is really the opening day. That real opening day is Monday, when there's all those games and you're – you know.
Right. Do you remember when it was in Cincinnati every year? You remember that when we were kids because it was the first ball club and everything?
I don't
They always open the season with Cincinnati at like 1:30 Eastern time or 1 o'clock Eastern time. And I don't mind these games in Australia because they're doing it for their financial reasons or whatever. But all I'm saying is can they play a golf major in Australia and not baseball? Wouldn't that be better?
Way better.
A sport that they actually are into.
Although, you look at – like you do it in the summertime down there. I mean, it was like 108 at the Australian Open.
Did you see Puig hit that cricket ball, by the way?
No.
He hit it like 4.5 miles. No one could find it.
I didn't see that.
Yeah. So let's go. Let's talk about it. What are we going to get into first?
Well, I want to go – we'll start with the local teams.
Okay.
You know, we've talked via articles on the site or on the show or with a lot of callers calling about all the moves the Yankees made. And, you know, comments have been across the board. At one point I told – I talked about how much money they spent, and I had somebody yell at me saying that their payroll is actually reduced.
Right.
Which is only because they don't have to pay the $24 million to A-Rod, but that's here or there. Their payroll is still $202 million this year, second highest in baseball, highest in the American League. They go out and spend the $75 million on McCann, $175 million on Tanaka – You know, what was it, $45 million with Beltran over 3 years,
something like that.
Yeah. And then, you know, Ellsbury gets the gigantic deal.
Brett Gardner.
They go out and
$56 million.
They get Brett Gardner $56 million. Derek Jeter gets $12 million to
just bet
$220 million. And but so I want to get your thoughts on him because people were saying that I'm like this big negative guy, but Vegas has him at what 83 wins or something like that.
Yeah.
It's not like they are all. I mean, I'm hearing people picking him to win 90 games. Cliff Floyd was on the Fan today talking about the Yankees are going to win 90 plus games. I just have a hard time believing. It's the same way last year. People were talking about the team, and I raised the same issues. These are all injury prone guys. They've got they're older, and why we had a caller call up and say, look. Euclid doesn't have to be the Euclid of old. All he's got to do is give us 25 home runs and 85
that's
RBIs. And I was like, oh, is that all Kevin Euclid has to do?
Yeah.
I think he gave us the...
That's it.
Yeah. I mean, that's all he's got to do. So that's like what they're saying about McCann. McCann doesn't have a catch every day. He's got to catch 130 games. When's the last time Brian McCann caught 130 games?
You know what I would find interesting would be if you took the uniforms off these Yankees and took the names away, and then you replaced them with, like, Royals uniforms.
Yeah.
Yankee fans would be telling you that team would be lucky to win 83 games.
Mm-hmm.
That's just the way it is. And I'm not killing on Yankee fans. I got a lot of them in my family. I love a lot of people that are Yankee fans. All I'm saying is, when you look across the board, and we were talking before we got on the show a little bit about, well, I was talking about Tanaka. I'm just not sold on him. And I like McCann. I've always liked McCann. He plays the game the right way. Love Euclid and those guys. But I've watched a couple spring training games, and I look at it and I go, and you know I'm a big Jeter fan, and I go, no idea what we're going to get from him. I have no idea what you're going to get from Teixeira, if he even stays healthy. You have no idea what Brian Roberts can give you. You have no idea what Kelly Johnson can give you.
Yeah.
And then you look around, and you know, again, I love Ellsbury, and I'm a big fan.
He's already hurt.
Yeah, I'm a big fan of the way he plays the game, but you go, what are you going to get from him? What's Gardner going to do? What's Beltran going to do? And I like Beltran as a player.
Yeah.
But he's up there in age.
I feel like Beltran
injuries.
Of these guys is the safest bet. Because although they talk about his knee, because he had those knee issues at the end of his med career, since then he's actually been able to stay upright
Of all the guys I just mentioned, I would say you're probably right.
And he's going to be DHing most of the time. It's like the guys that I'm least worried about are Beltran and Soriano.
Yeah.
On the entire team.
And then you get into the pitching staff.
Yeah.
And, I mean, we both like Sabathia, but you go, you know what, he's eating a lot of innings.
All he's got to do is just turn into the next Andy Pettit. Now that he throws 88.
Yeah. You know, you look at a guy like Kuroda. I've already told you that something about Tanaka, and I don't have any facts to give anybody. There's just something about him that screams Daisuke Matsuzaka, like after the one good year Daisuke had. There's just something about him where I go, I don't trust him. And I said to you off air, I go, he looks like a 10-14 pitcher, and he's talking as if it's not important to him to pitch against the Red Sox. And you know what? If that's the case, then you should stay over in Tokyo or Kyoto, wherever he's coming from, and pitch over there. If you want to pitch for the New York Yankees, could you imagine Whitey Ford or Andy Pettit not wanting the ball?
Exactly.
Or Ron
Guidry?
Absolutely. There's no way. So now you're telling me you're saving him so he can pitch. I think it's in Toronto, but it's against the Blue Jays. That's where you're saving him for?
Yeah.
This is the guy you just gave $175 million to.
Right.
The bullpen, we've talked about how fickle bullpens can be, so you never know. I mean, their bullpen could be lights out.
Yeah,
everybody
wants the best, the Mets bullpen, isn't that? You could just flip a coin. Unless
you've
got a bullpen like the Braves had, you know, you have Kimbrel at the back end, you've got Jordan Walden and a couple other flamethrowers, or you've got a bullpen like, you know, the Cardinals, who are just amazing every year. Other than that, they're all flip a coin. You know, there's going to be a guy like a Steve Delabar comes out of nowhere and is great, and there's going to be those kind of guys. I'm not that worried about their bullpen. I think Robertson's going to be fine.
I do too.
Mariano, I think he's going to be fine. He's a guy who's going to be a lot more of a traditional closer that gets himself into trouble and gets himself out, because he was the king of that. He's the king of getting himself bases loaded jams and then striking out the side type guy. I think he's lived like that. You know,
I like him, though. He's got good stuff.
I love him.
Have a good,
he's
like,
got that
little
deception. He like leaps towards the mound, so the ball gets right on top of you.
Where's his socks up high?
He wears, that's,
you know I'm a fan.
That's how I rock mine. So I agree, and I think that the pressure he was put under to be the setup man for Mariano was as close to being a closer as you can get, because everybody just assumed you get a lead to the ninth inning, it's game over.
Yeah.
So you've got that ride on it. Like, man, I don't want to be the one to blow it because I know Mo's not going to blow it. You know, so I feel like that is as good of a transition as you can get.
And
pitching,
you know,
in Yankee Stadium leading up to Mariano?
Yep, and you know what I wouldn't undersell, and some people kind of poo-poo this in all the four major sports? He's had a few years now to sit out there in that bullpen for 6 or 7 innings with Mariano and pick his brain about different things. And I think I don't think you can overstate the importance of that. This is the greatest relief pitcher of all time, and he's had the ability to kind of serve an apprenticeship under him just to pick up from him. And then on top of it, like we talked about, and it's probably way more important, but he's got good stuff, seems to have a good head on his shoulders. So I'm not worried about that. But what I would worry about if I'm a Yankee fan is if the starting pitching comes apart at the seams a little bit and you start getting guys giving you 5 1/3, 5 2/3, a good bullpen most of the time will fall apart by July, because now you have guys, instead of throwing, I don't know, 12 innings a week, 10 innings a week, they could be throwing 20.
Yeah.
And now next thing you know, you look up in the dog days and you go, my God, I mean, like last year, like Boone Logan's got 450 appearances. And you go, what the hell happened to the rest of the bullpen? Well, it's like, well, your starters weren't good. That's why you and I have both agreed, I think, you know, for the same reason, CC will pitch like a bulldog. He'll
That's
give
why
you all
I love
the
him.
Innings.
And I used to argue with my former co-host, I was blue in the face about the importance of that. He's like, well, he's not a real, front-of-the-line starter because look at his ERA, look at his whip, he gives up too many hits, and blah, blah, blah. I'm like, this guy will give up 3 in the first and still pitch 7 innings.
Yeah, he'll throw 120 pitches.
This guy will do it time and time again. He'll throw 35 pitches in the first inning, but then you look up and it's the 6th inning and he's got a manageable, like, 100-pitch count, and you're like, oh, he can give me a 7th inning.
Right.
You know, there's not a lot of guys that could do that, who could manage damage and do those type of things. And I think he could still probably be that guy. Even that guy last year, as bad of a season as he had,
yeah,
he still was up over 200 innings. You know, he's going to give you that. I just think you look down the line at the rest of the staff. You look at Kuroda's second half. They gave him $16 million.
Mm-hmm.
He was just atrocious down the stretch. And he's like 38, 39 yeah. years old. Everybody just assumes Pineda. When they got him, they thought they were, you know, what they were getting for the Montero. They were saying, well, we got a legitimate number two starter.
How much you want to bet he doesn't win 10 games?
Oh, I wouldn't make that bet.
Yeah, of course not.
I wouldn't make that bet.
I mean,
this is
the
guy
who
hasn't pitched in the major leagues in 2 years.
Yeah,
I mean, assuming he's going to come in and be a fifth starter and give you, what, 15 wins? I mean, what are they expecting out of him?
I don't know.
He looks good, but
would you take the over, 83? Would you, if it was 83.5, would you take the over on the Yankees?
No, I would not.
You wouldn't? What would you take?
I think, I honestly, if you were to put a gun to my head, I would say they're going to win 81 games. I think they're going to be an 81-81 team. I think that I think that the Blue Jays will be better. They're still not going to be a playoff team, but I think they're going to be better. I think that the Rays are the team to beat in the East.
Do you really?
I really do. I think you get a guy like Will Myers, who is like that star power guy that they needed to kind of to be, you know, no batting gloves. I knew you would love him.
Love him.
Just rakes. If Evan Longoria could stay healthy, Desmond Jennings has been a guy they've been talking about his potential for a long time. And they have all those other pieces. And then they've got just young arm after young arm after young arm they can keep throwing out there. And they've got a great manager who's able to tweak his lineup and understands what to do with his starting pitching and all the rest. I think that they're the team to beat. I mean, I know you're staring at the Boston Red Sox, reigning World Series champs. To me, I mean, everything broke their way last year with everything that happened. And, you know, maybe they're going to catch lightning in a bottle with Grady Sizemore. As crazy as that might sound, he hasn't played in the league in about 5 years. But, it looks like he's going to win this battle between him and Jackie Bradley Jr., one of their biggest prospects, and he could be their opening day center fielder. And, he's looked great. He's still only in his early 30s.
Yeah.
So it's not outrageous. I mean, he's making plays. He looks quick again in the outfield. He's making plays, hitting
like
the ball.
Like you said, he's had plenty of time to rest.
Well, yeah.
He hasn't been playing in Cleveland.
So then, I mean, how frustrating that would be for Mets fans who have no outfielders. They could. And I had written an article last year about how they should take a flyer on him, sign him to a minor league deal. Let him, even if he doesn't play last year, let him, you know, sign him to a $1 million minor league deal so you have him and then give him a shot. But watch him go out there this year and become even a fraction of what he was at his peak, which was a legitimate five-tool guy. I could see. I think it's going to be a two-legged race. I actually really like the offense for the Baltimore Orioles. That's probably the longest lineup in maybe even all of the AL, I honestly think. But I just don't trust their pitching at all.
No, and in that park. I mean, it's almost a park that is so weird because it's built for the kind of offense they have.
Yeah.
But then if you don't have, like, an elite-style, like, 2010 San Francisco Giants staff, it's so hard to keep runs down. And you get to a point where you almost need to score 900 to 1,000 runs to be relevant.
Yeah.
In terms of what you said about Tampa, I love the Rays, which I'm sure you would assume I do.
Yeah.
I love Joe Maddon, love the young guys, love that conveyor belt of young pitchers, love that they just form bullpens out of nowhere. But in my mind, I just think that mood around the Red Sox will continue. I just think for all the reasons you said, I like Tampa, but I would take Boston if I had to pick a team to win that division. Now you got a shot of 3 teams from one division getting into the playoffs, so you could have something crazy. I think they'll both get in.
Yeah.
But there's just something about the way John Farrell runs that team, the mood of everything last year with the kidding around, and they just grow their beards out, and they have mohawks, and they don't care. Boston's an awesome baseball city that those guys love to play in, love everything about what they built there. I'm taking Boston, and I like Tampa for second, and I think the Yankees are something about it. Like I might take that over, that they would win like 84 games.
80, yeah.
Because it's the Yankees. I don't know if
they win last year, 85?
I think
like
so.
That? Yeah.
But I agree with you on everything else, too. I mean, the Jays being better, I like the Orioles lineup, but I don't like the pitching, and I don't like it, especially playing 81 games in that park and then a bunch of other games in other hitters' parks in that division. You're going to have to outscore everybody.
Yeah, I think going into last year, everybody looked at the AL East and said, I mean, if you remember, everybody picked Boston to finish last, but that was supposed to be just far and away the most devastating division in all of baseball, and it really did not pan out that way, obviously, when you look at what happened with Toronto and the Yankees. But I think that this year it's going to come to fruition. It's kind of flying under the radar a little bit. But I think, you know, if you're a pitching staff in the AL East, you got to be really good because you're going to face that Toronto team, could put runs on the board. That Baltimore team is going to put 4 or 5 runs on the board in their sleep. You know, you look at the Red Sox. The worst offense on paper is the Rays, but I think their style will allow them to stay and just get them enough. They're not going to be the 12, you know, beat you 12-8.
I love.
They'll win enough 6-5, 5-4 games.
Yeah, I'm going to go really way out on a limb here. I love pitching, defense, and smart teams, and Joe Maddon finds a way to maximize 25 guys, the best out of 25 guys, it seems, every year, and he does it as well. I know some people kind of downplay managers. To me, he just sets the tone for a young team, a talented team. So, you know, yeah, they could definitely go places, man. I mean, I would take a team in that division that pitches and plays defense and does the fundamentals over a team like Baltimore. I really would, because it's just over the long run. You watch it when those Rangers got in the World Series against San Fran. They just got shut down by a team that pitched, played defense, hit behind runners, bunched guys over. So I love everything about the Rays, other than their ballpark. They got to get them a new park. I'm tired of watching that hellhole that they planned down there. It's just a dump.
There's no denying that. Now, moving over to the NL East and the Mets, you know, we had our very own show. We had Bobo call up and say he thinks they're a 95-win team.
God bless him.
And God bless him. Yeah. So we laughed about it, but the next week, Alderson comes out and says he thinks they're a 90-win team, and David Wright backs him up. Clearly, they listen to the show. We know that.
Absolutely.
Sandy's probably listening right now, Sandy, so go out and do your best this season. But, you know, They're over under somewhere around the 74.5 range, something like that. What's interesting to me is that there are ways you could make an argument for ways that they can get to a 500 weight team. But if you make those arguments, okay, the pitching staff stays healthy and pitches up to their capability. You get some production out of whoever wins that first base battle. They're both going to be on the opening day roster, Duda and Ike Davis. I think in their heart of hearts, the Mets want Ike Davis to win that job because I think he's a Gold Glove caliber first baseman. He's very good over there. And I think that they want him to be that guy, and maybe they could shop Duda around. I don't think they're going to get much for either one of them. Whoever loses that battle, it's not like they're going to go out and add this great arm or something like that. But you make that argument there. You make an argument for, the improved defense in the outfield helping out this pitching staff. Maybe Chris Young becomes a 2020 guy again. You can make all those arguments, but if you make those arguments, you sound like a diehard Met fan, you know. But you also hear the same arguments you made from the Yankee fans as to how the Yankees are going to win 90 games. All these guys stay healthy, and Pineda comes back, and Tanaka comes in. So it's the same type of thing, but when the Mets do it, you sound like a, you know, this rah-rah Met fan. I think that they are a upper 70-win team. I think they are a little bit improved. And, you know, people say, how do they improve when they don't have Harvey? You know, they didn't win a lot of games with Matt Harvey last year.
Right.
So it's not like that number of 74 wins was super inflated because of Matt Harvey. He lost a lot. He had a million no decisions. It's not like he was going out there winning. You know, he didn't go 15-2 and everybody else was way under 500. You know, they weren't winning a lot of games with him. So it's not like all of a sudden you interjected and they were going to get a big spike in losses just from that. I think that it does come down to their pitching staying healthy. And I think it does come down to some of these guys on offense have to pan out. I mean, some of them have to. Darnold has to pan out eventually. He's got a couple home runs in the last couple games. I know your boy Wrecker's still crushing the ball down there. But, you know, a year ago, everybody in the world was telling us Darnold was the best hitting catching prospect in baseball. Now he's like an afterthought.
Well, I mean, then you find out that the kid spent 6 or 7 years in the minor leagues. And I know there's guys like a Paul LaDuca, and there's a bunch of other guys that spend a lot of time in the minor leagues and come up and they do well. Kevin Millar is another guy, like, you know, who was a scab and then comes in, and, you know, so that stuff happens. But when I find out that an elite catching prospect spent half
and
a dozen...
he wasn't stuck behind a big stud in
Toronto.
I mean,
he's playing behind J.P. Arencibia and whoever, John Buck for a while, and I mean, you look at that and go, he wasn't ready playing up in Syracuse.
I was worried about that last year when they weren't ready to push him up.
Yeah.
It's not like he's young and they got to worry about his Super 2 status and all the rest. Because he's like 24, 25.
Yeah, I mean, I've said it to you. I'll say it to, you know, our listeners that I don't see much from him. I see, you know, we've had the discussions about metrics and how you judge a guy or whatever. I'm looking at just his swing. Yep. I'm looking at just his hand placement. I'm looking at just his bat speed compared to average to slightly above average hitting big leaguers. And I don't see it. I don't see it. I saw the good eye last year. He came up, I think, in San Diego, right? That was his first game out there at Petco, and he had 3 walks, and then he had 7 walks in his first 10 games. You go, okay, that's a guy who can get on base.
Yeah.
That's like a good player for Oakland a la 2001,
mm-hmm.
but he just doesn't look like he's going to hit. I mean, to me...
yeah, he's supposed to be this guy with his power. He showed zero power.
Yeah, I just... To me, I could be totally wrong, and I'll admit it if I am. I just don't see it with him, and it has nothing to do with wanting to see record play. I'm just speaking objectively about what I see with him. We've had the Ike versus Duda discussion before where I've said, I think long-term, I think Duda is the guy who will hit better. I agree that he's not exactly Keith Hernandez at first base,
yeah.
but I think he's a guy that if he was on an American League team, you'd go, you know what, this is a guy we could use. This guy we could use against right-hand pitching. It's a guy we could DH. It's a guy who could pinch hit. So I like him. I love Murphy. I've mentioned that here before. If I had to take a guess on the Mets, I'd say a lot of it comes down to the pitching and, like you said, getting some offense from someplace. And you're playing in a big park. I know they moved the fences in. I would go with like 76, 77 wins for that.
Yeah.
And I've said to you, I think you're in a much better place than a Cubs fan. So I don't see why Met fans are depressed other than, you know, Harvey being on the shelf with an arm. But I think the Mets are heading someplace. I just don't know how quickly they'll get there. But I like them for about, you know, 676, 77 wins.
So talking about the rest of the NL East, I mean, is this just Washington's year to make this run? I mean, as bad as – as disappointing as Washington was last year, they wound up winning like 86, 87 games. They made this crazy run towards the end where they almost put themselves in the playoffs. And so – you look at them now, they add Doug Fister, just like, oh, we're just going to go add him. Just add another, you know. So their staff is just insanely good.
Yep.
I mean, people talk about different staffs in the league. I don't see another staff in the league that comes close to them. When you look at Strasburg, Zimmerman, Gio Gonzalez, Doug Fister, that's insane.
Yep.
Those are 4 number ones. Zimmerman's a number one anywhere else. Gio Gonzalez is number one. Fister's at worst a 2 or, you know, a great 3.
Yeah.
And you get those 4 guys. Then on offense, you know, you got Deion Desmond. You've got everyone's favorite, Bryce Harper. You can hear all
your
about
your favorite.
My very favorite
ball player. Better than Mike Trout, you know.
No, yeah, well, he should be. I mean, that's a fair debate whether we should debate whether Mike Trout and Bryce Harper are in the same conversation. But so, you know, I think I look at them and you're like, well, yeah, they're going to run away with it. The Braves always scare me, but they lost 2 great young arms, so that's gonna kill them. I mean, although they could replace it like no other franchise, where they could just be like, oh, we got Alex Wood, who last year just threw up a sub-1 ERA in his 5 starts in the majors, no big deal. So they just have those kind of guys, and they still got the great bend of the bullpen.
Yep.
They still got a good lineup, as we all know. You know, I think Adelson Simmons is the guy you're going to see really burst onto the scene this
year.
I
like him.
I mean, this
like
guy's going to be a 25 home run guy this year, 280, 20, and Gold Glove caliber shortstop. I mean, he's, for some reason, playing for a major franchise like the Braves, he still kind of flies under the radar. I don't know why.
Well, even their own fans don't go to the games.
Yeah,
I think a lot of that is what it comes down to, because if he played in New York, Chicago, L.A., Philly, someplace like that, people will go, my God, this is the second coming of, like, you know, Barry Larkin. And he gets, you know, he gets under the radar down there. The thing I worry about with Washington, and it's just a voodoo thing, but a couple years ago when they just decided they're going to just sit Strasburg and
that's
not take a rush at everything, that's like implying that you're just going to make a never-ending run of playoff.
We're going to have a decade of championship runs.
And that bothers me, and I still think, because he was a gamer when he played, he's a great manager, I think that just ate at Davey Johnson. Like, you're telling me I can't – wait a second. I can't throw my best pitcher out there because he's got a pitch limit thing? And then you saw what the Braves did with Medlin. Like, they ran him out of the bullpen for a while so that he could start down the stretch.
Yeah,
like, it made sense. Like, they were – and you look at Rizzo in Washington, and you go – that's just bad karma that's going to be around you for a while. And I know that it wasn't just him. It was probably the ownership or whatever saying, look, we got to protect these kids.
I'm sure it was.
You know? But that, to me, is just a bad baseball move. They baby these kids. I think you got to throw innings. You got to do things like that. You got to long toss like we were all taught when we were young. You got to do those things to build arm strength. You don't baby a kid.
No.
And I just think that at some point, it might not be in their division this year. They'll probably get a playoff berth. Somewhere down the stretch, there's got to be like a Bill Buckner-type hop or a Leon Durham thing that goes over your shoelace or something that happens to the Nets.
My heart wants that so much because when they did that on the – I was just lambasting them on the show talking about how ridiculous that is because it's just the pompous attitude of, oh, we got to save them.
We'll be back.
Because they're the Nationals. Like the former Expo franchise who's just a perennial, you know, pennant winner. You finally have this team that rolling, like ready to go, and he was throwing fantastic. I mean, he did not show any signs of slowing up.
Yeah.
And they're just like, no, put the brakes. We had our 150. It's just some number they pick out of the air that's not scientific because there's no way to scientifically prove anything. The stress on your arm in this inning compared to the next inning, all of the rest, how many times you're up and down during a rain delay or whatever. You know, there's a million different things. So to just throw 150 innings and act like that is, you know exactly what the strain of 150 major league innings is going to do to your arm is insanity.
Yeah.
I don't know what the right answer is, but it's not that.
And I just want to know when they were doing that, where was Jack Morris? Where was a guy like Burt Blyleven?
David Cohn, he's throwing 150.
Yeah, absolutely. Or Nolan Ryan, or those guys just going, what in the hell this team doing? And let alone those old-time guys like Whitey Ford and Juan Marichal and those guys who would just throw 500 innings a month, and they just didn't care. And so to me, I mean, just talking objectively about their team, they are the best team in the division. You see a lot of holes in a lot of the teams, and plus the fact you just got a whipping boy with the Miami Marlins that you should just be able to just beat the hell out of for probably 10 wins a year, even the Mets or the Phillies or whoever. So, yeah, I do like Washington win that division, but I think at some point those mistakes come back to bite you, those little errors that you make, and when the karmic beings get a hold of you, I don't know, man. There's nothing I would trust about that team just because of some of the decisions they've made in the past.
So let me ask you then, I mean – we're gonna have all season long to talk about, but who's your World Series matchup?
Oh,
on
boy.
The surface here. You want me to do mine first?
Yeah,
go ahead. About it. I still like St. Louis. I think that they just reload. It's like no big deal. I think Matt Adams. I've had conversations with people that talk about. I mean, I had a conversation with somebody who's like, well, Matt Adams isn't gonna be playing full time because once Oscar Tavares is ready, he's gonna be platooning because they're gonna move. I mean. Matt Adams is hitting every level of the minor leagues.
And he just hits balls so far you can't find him.
He's got an OPA close to 1,000 in the minor leagues. In last year, in his first season up there, when they finally give him a full-time job, in 296 at-bats, he hit 17 home runs, 51 RBI. Like, what else do you want the guy to do? This guy is just a beast of a guy.
Does anybody hit the ball harder than him?
No. That guy, you wouldn't talk about country strong if you just have his picture. And he hit 284. And in the minor leagues, his strikeout numbers were not high. I mean, he struck out a decent amount last year, but that's that transition. I don't see him being, you know, there's some crazy comparison. Oh, he could be an Adam Dunn. Not even close. This guy batted 284 last year in his rookie season. And his strikeout numbers were relatively high, but not Adam Dunn-like. And he didn't have a history of doing that in the minor leagues. I think you get a guy like him, he's going to be just an absolute stud. Colton Wong, they could just plug in there at second base. You know, he's going to be fine. They shift Carpenter over to third base. That's fine. You know, he's not a prototypical third baseman offensive production wise, but I don't buy into all that. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And I had an argument, and I won't mention the name of with a sabermetrician who wants to tell me that a stat of, you know, they led the league by far in batting average with running and scoring position, and he wanted to tell me that's a fluky stat. Which to me just screams you've never played the game of baseball.
Right.
Because I playing at any level, you know the guys you want up in a big spot, and you know the guys like we used to call lamb slayers who might be able to bat 350, but in a big spot they can never get a hit.
Yeah.
You know those guys. And granted, it was crazy how, I mean, they batted like 300 with running scrims. It might not be that high, but that's the type of team they have. They've got guys like Matt Holliday who people just forget about the fact that he's just 30, 100, you know, every year, 300, 100 RBIs every single year, and runners in scoring position, he just does it. Molina just does it. Alan Craig is a machine when it comes to that.
Yeah.
That's not a fluky stat. Am I out of my...
No, I mean, I had someone once tell me who's into the metrics that the only reason Derek Jeter is labeled as a clutch hitter is because of how frequently he came up in the clutch because of the quality of the teams he was on, which at that point, you just need like an afternoon of like electroshock therapy to shock you back into reality that you would actually criticize Derek Jeter as being one of the most clutch players of all time. So those things are stupid. Those things are just ridiculously dumb to say.
Just take Derek Jeter. And people think I bash him. I think he's arguably the greatest shortstop of all time. But when he hits, when he got, he's got to get to 3,000 hits.
Yeah.
He does it in fashion.
He just hits a homer.
He hits a home run in a big, David Price in a big spot in the game.
Yeah.
And put, I think he had 4 or 5 hits that game. Yeah. It was like something, you know, it was insane that he does it that way. But of course he did it that way.
Because
he's got that extra gear that put, like, that's what makes Derek Jeter Derek Jeter. Right. And you're going to tell me that's a fluky thing that he just happened to do that? Or he's always involved in these big plays on the big stage. He just happens to be involved in that? That's somebody that's never played the game.
Yeah. No, I agree with you 100%. You know my stance on all that stuff. I'm not saying there's not a place for those kinds of metrics in the game. All I'm saying is they come across like pompous idiots, and they make guys like us feel bad about actually knowing something about the game. So,
well, like you said, the best point you've ever made, it makes it not fun to talk about.
Yeah.
Because I could sit there and you could debate me and tell me, oh, I watch Matt Adams, and I think he stinks. I think he's got a hole in his swing.
Right.
I think he's got a very short swing for a big guy, which is what I like. And I like to talk about that kind of thing. Like, he's not a guy who just jumped off the board like this. But when you start just talking about sabermetrics, it just drives me insane.
Yeah, here's the ball I'll put on it. Like, you take a guy like Travis d'Arnaud that we're talking about. My opinion, judging it by watching him play, is that he will not pan out to be a very good big league player. If I turn out to be wrong and he turns into a 280, 20, and 80 guy, I'll just eat crow and say I was wrong. If the metrics, which I don't know if they do, but if let's say they bear out that he's going to be a really good big league hitter and then he's not, every single one of them you see on the TV turns around and goes, well, you know, the numbers were a little bit misleading. So thereby, you're never wrong.
Yeah.
You're never wrong. Guys like us are wrong. Okay?
Yeah.
But to just say who I like now that I've had some time to think about it, I'm gonna go with Boston.
I'm gonna take Boston.
No, to win the American League.
We don't have to give our
pick. And I'm going to tell you where I'm going in the National League. Okay, I'm going to go with the only NL Central team I can stomach. I'm going to go with Pittsburgh.
Is that right?
I'm going to go with Pittsburgh on the heels of what they did last year. They got the young pitching with the, who was it,
Garrett Cole.
UCLA guy, like him, seen him pitch. Love Clint Hurdle. Love what he did in Colorado. Think he got a bad rap there when he just, struggled a little bit. And
absolutely.
Like, hey, you know, this guy's a bum, get rid of him. That's the pick I'm going to go with now. And then, you know what, when you look up in, like, July and they're, like, 15 games under 500, I'll just make up, like, I didn't say it.
They're the team that all the experts want to tell you that they're going to come back crashing down the earth. And I think there's some credence only in that their bullpen was so good. Like, Grilly was so good last year. Can they duplicate that? But I think you get a guy like Cole, like you said, who is going to surpass what he gave them last year in limited action. He's going to be fantastic. I don't find Liriano being a guy who's going to take this big step back. You know, it's like he came out of nowhere. He was phenomenal when he came up. He had his arm issues. He seems to have figured it out. He looks like a stud. You know, I know they lost A.J. Burnett, but who gave them – you know, he gave them solid innings, good low ERA. He didn't give them a ton of wins last year. I think he was 11 or 12 wins for as good as he pitched. So that's replaceable. You look at their outfield, Starling Marte is on the verge of being a real breakout
big
star.
Fan of him.
Big fan of him. Obviously, McCutchen. You know, they've got Alvarez is the guy, though, I told everybody's going to be a bust. Finally, he has a season where he puts it together and hits 30-plus home runs. I still worry about that guy. Being a guy who consistently do it.
He's got a weird swing.
Yeah.
Have you noticed that? Like, if you get a chance to watch him and you really look at that. But to what you were saying about St. Louis, to me, there's three organizations that do things correctly. And you look at the Cardinals. To me, it's the Cardinals, the Red Wings, and the Spurs. Those three organizations just seem to make great decisions every single year, all the time. And it... As a Cubs fan, like, I can't even be anti-Cardinal because we talked about it last year and talking about the World Series. I love everything that they do. I love the way they play. I love the way Matheny manages that team. I love the fact that they call up a kid, and the next thing you know, like, Waka, he's just legitimate. Like, all of a sudden, out of the blue, they're like, oh, this kid's great.
Yeah.
Oh, by the way, like, he's a Cardinal. And you go, yeah, I knew that. Like, you wouldn't even have to know he's on the Cardinals. Is it a good young pitcher?
Yeah.
Well, let me guess. He's either on Tampa, Atlanta, or the Cardinals. You go, yeah, the Cardinals. He's on the Cardinals. So, yeah, I mean, it's hard to bet against them, but I'm going to go with Pittsburgh. I liked everything they did last year, and I love Cole. I love some of the stuff they have. I agree with you. The bullpen, we talked about, they can be fickle. You never know what you're going to get. But I'm going to go Pittsburgh, Boston.
I'm going to go – if I'm going to stay in the AL East. I'm going to go with Tampa.
To
go to the World Series. I think St. Louis is going to win it all. But I think Tampa Bay, this is their year. Every year you're like, well, they're going to make this run. They can only go so high. And it's like the Oakland Athletics where they can only, you know, they're their limited talent is only going to take them so far. When is it going to be the year? And I'm just going to say, roll the dice and say this is the year that they do make that next step.
Right.
And they are able to make it all the way to the World Series. And I think a lot of it has to do with people love Detroit. I did not like, I think you agree with me, the trade they made when they traded for Kinsler. I think people are going to be disappointed in what they see out of Kinsler, to be honest with you.
I love Kinsler. I just think it's a bad deal.
I mean, they're giving up this guy because he had a bad postseason and a somewhat down year, but the guy's still one of the most prolific power hitters in the game, and you're giving him up just because they got this guy Castellanos. So, like, we're going to be able to plug him at third. He's going to replace what Prince Fielder gave. Now, Castellanos is a great prospect, and I've watched him hit, and he looks like he's the real deal. But he's not going to step in and be Prince Fielder in year one.
No, and, I think if he comes in, and you'll remember him, if he comes in and plays like Travis Fryman, they won. I mean, if he plays at that level, forget being like Mike Schmidt, but if he just plays like Travis Fryman this year, that's a legitimate team, I think. But I can't get past that because you've seen Kinsler's numbers dwindle.
Especially his batting averages dwindle.
And now you put him in this park.
Numbers. Yeah.
Take him out of the ballpark in Arlington.
Yeah.
And put him in Detroit, which is just massive.
Yeah, I mean, you traded away a cornerstone first baseman for a guy who's probably going to hit somewhere 250, 260 with 18 to 20 home runs.
Yeah.
From the second base spot, that's great. But, you know, where you're going to make the rest of it up with what you're going to get out of Castellanos. I don't know. I just feel like they're a team. They're a playoff team. I agree. Some people are still high on the Royals. I
can't do it anymore.
I can't either.
I can't. I want to.
They're a team that ESPN and Sports Illustrated have force-fed to us for 5 years about how this is their great organization and this and that. I think Moustakas stinks. I think Hosmer's for real. The guy Ventura, the pitcher, he's going to be pretty good. But and then in the West, you know.
You're still on it.
Well, I love the West. But the Rangers, I don't think they've got the pitching to really make a run. The Angels are an interesting team because now all of a sudden the back end of their rotation, they got Skaggs and Santiago in that trade for Trumbo. And so they got a couple good young arms to complement C.J. Wilson and Weaver at the top, and they got Garrett Richards in there. You know, I think that they're a very interesting team. I could see them possibly making a run, but I'm not going to put my money on a team like that. All of these things, the new young arms they got coming together, plus all of these older players having this renaissance year. So that's where I'm going with. But let's take another quick break.
So
we come back, we're going to give you the keyword to win your 10% off D'Amato Landscaping spring cleanups, and we might talk to a greatest of all time at his position, Jerry Rice. We'll be right back with the Tri-State Sports Guys.
Bud Light presents Real Men of Genius.
Real Men of Genius.
Today we salute you, Mr. Fantasy Football Manager Guy.
Mr. Fantasy Football Manager Guy.
Every year you assemble your closest friends to prepare for another season in the knockdown, drag-out world of make-believe football.
4 minutes.
You were born with the one skill every manager needs to play fantasy football. Absolutely no skill playing real football.
Not so good at catching.
Imaginary catches. Imaginary touchdowns. Next up, an imaginary score with an imaginary woman.
Good imagination.
So crack open a nice cold Bud Light, oh Swami of the sidelines. You may come in dead last, but you're always first with us.
Mr. Fantasy Football Manager Guy.
Bud Light Beer, Anheuser-Busch, St. Louis, Missouri.
Never thought I'd say that.
All right, we're back. Tri-State Sports Guys. Check us out, as always, tristatesportsguys.com, facebook.com/tristatesportsguys, or @tristate_sports. Now, we got to give our sponsors a little love here. Good friends over at D'Amato Landscaping. Their website, as always, damatolawn.com. You can give them a call at 203-286-8062. Now, the keyword to get your 10% off is going to be Tanaka for you.
Okay.
I'm giving you Tanaka.
Love it.
You just call them up, say the keyword Tanaka, they give you 10% off your spring cleanups. I think it'll be fantastic.
I'm a big fan of that keyword you just gave, buddy.
Yeah. So let's get to some NFL talk here as we wait to be joined by the great Jerry Rice. I mean, a lot of craziness going on free agent-wise, obviously. There's some obviously turmoil up in Buffalo. They lose their owner, who's owned the team from the inception.
Right.
And then you have obviously the tragedy that's going on with Jim Kelly. I mean, those pictures are just devastating.
Yeah.
So it's kind of tough. I mean, even as a Jet fan, it's hard to swallow something, seeing something like that. You know, one of the most prolific owners in all of football. But let's liven things up a little bit. And all our thoughts and prayers go out to everybody up in Boston. Let's liven things up. We're going to go out. We posted on our Facebook page, you know, how many people can you point to in all of sports, in any sport, where you could say this guy was the greatest at his position? And there's a handful of guys. You may want to say Jordan, best guard of all time, maybe best basketball player of all time, Mariano, best closer. But there's very few of them. And when we asked that, we posed the question last night, the one name that kept popping up was Jerry Rice. So now joining us on the Tucci Lumber Hotline, San Francisco 49er great, Mr. Jerry Rice. Mr. Rice, are you with us?
Yeah, I'm with you guys. How you guys doing?
I'm doing great, Jerry. How you doing?
I'm doing fantastic, man. I'm really looking forward to, having this conversation with you guys and also talking some football.
I mean, nothing better. It is really a 12-month-a-year sport, and we could talk about it, all day and all night here. And I will say this, you know, we're up in the Northeast, Giant and Jet country, although my producer's a big Buffalo Bill fan. But I will tell you, 2 years ago, I'm a season ticket holder of the Jets. I go to the game against San Francisco, and I was shocked at the amount of San Francisco 49er jerseys. This is the game where Colin Kaepernick scored his first touchdown. Everybody's like, who the hell is that guy? And he scores that, and I think that obviously has a lot to do with your team back in the 80s that made that a nationwide franchise. And we had your former teammate Guy McIntyre on a couple weeks back, and I asked him the question. I'm going to ask you the same question. You know, you had a team. There's been a lot of dynasty-type teams, but your team, you had three guys who are arguably the best player to ever play their position in yourself, in Joe Montana, and in Ronnie Lott. And I asked him, I'm going to ask you, when you were in the midst of that run, did you guys realize how special that team was?
Man, I think so every day because of the way we worked. We never took anything for granted. We respected our opponent, but we put all the preparation in during the week, and guys had to come to work every day. You know, every day was like a game situation, the focus, the intensity, the attention to detail, and I think that's why we were able to win so many football games. But Eddie DiBarlo, he was the owner of the San Francisco 49ers, and ever since the Niners started to win Super Bowls, there was a lot of pressure here in San Francisco, and we just felt like we had to work hard and live up to that expectation.
Yeah, I mean, as you mentioned, you know, that team just had such an identity, and all the players are so iconic in the NFL history of being part of that team. And you look at guys, and you went through this, and you look at what, like, Steve Smith is going through right now. Face of the franchise out there in Carolina, has to go play. Now he's going to Baltimore. And, you know, as a fan, we like to romanticize the idea of the relationship between a player and his team and a player and his city. And I think Steve Smith is taking this to heart. Now, you went through that when you went up to Oakland. What was that like? I mean, you lived exactly what Steve Smith's about to go through. What was that like to leave the team?
I was very angry, guys, very angry, because I felt I poured my heart into San Francisco. I the way I practiced every day, the way I was out in the community, but it boils down to it's a business, and eventually you got to look at it that way. I still wanted to play football, and John Gruden at that time told me, he said, Jerry, look, you can come to the Raiders and you can catch around 80 balls or more. And I just felt like, you know, the fire was still inside me. I went over to the Raiders and I wanted to prove the San Francisco 49ers wrong. I wanted to prove to that organization that I could still play football and that I was not ready to walk away from the game. And I think I had an exceptional year that year, and I went back to the Pro Bowl.
Yeah, you actually put up back-to-back fantastic years, 80 catches, 1,100, 90 catches, 1,200, which actually leads me to my next question, which is, it's a question that can't be answered, because I think that people want to use it to prove whatever point they're trying to make. And that's kind of the chicken or the egg question of, well, this wide receiver is really good because this so-and-so's throwing him the ball, and this this quarterback's really good because you hear that with Peyton Manning. Oh, he's got all these weapons. But then when Eric Decker gets traded to the Jets, everybody wants to say, well, he's only good because Peyton Manning's throwing him the ball. Well, you proved you could do it with different quarterbacks. What is that line there between a quarterback making a wide receiver great or a wide receiver making a quarterback look great?
guys, I really think you have to complement each other. And, you know, with Joe Montana, after being in sync with him for so many years, then all of a sudden Steve Young took over that offense and now having to adapt to Steve. So I did it with so many quarterbacks. And the main thing is when you can elevate a player and make him better. And I feel like I was that type of guy. I'm sure Joe Montana felt like he was that type of guy, and also Steve Young. So you have to be able to adapt, but, you know, you have to meet each other halfway, and you have to put the time in, the chemistry, and doing the extra work after practice.
Jerry, this is Dan. I wanted to ask a little bit about coming out of a school like Mississippi Valley State, and you see so many guys come out of these so-called non-powerhouse schools like yourself, John Randall, Terrell Owens, guys that come into the league and become great players. What is it that kind of leads you guys to these schools? Are you just overlooked by the big schools? And then why do you think some of you guys come into the league and are just so talented and so good for the teams you go to?
Well, I'm just going to use myself for example. I got letters from all the major schools, but Mississippi Valley, they sent a head coach out to talk to me face-to-face. And whenever you can look a guy in his eyes, shake his hand, you know, that really convinced me to go to Mississippi Valley State University. And at that time, they were getting ready to do something special by using the no-huddle, the run and shoot, and so many formations with receivers. So I felt like that was a better chance of me making it to the next level by going to Mississippi Valley State. But a lot of the small schools, I just feel like we don't get the recognition that we really deserve. And it's hard for those scouts to come in and make a decision and say, hey, look, you know, we're going to make this guy our number one draft choice in the first round, you know, coming from a very small school like Mississippi Valley State University. But Bill Walsh, he was that genius. You know, he could see talent, and he knew that I could be successful in the NFL, and I was able to come in and work hard and find my place.
Well, you know, we sit here every week, and we have these about NFL draft and guys coming out. Last week we were talking about some wideouts, and you're the perfect man, obviously, to shed some light on this. What is it that you're looking for when you look at these college wideouts like Sammy Watkins or Marquise Lee or Brandon Cooks? What are some of the things you're looking for and maybe that separate the guys that you think might be good opposed to the guys you think might be just great NFL players?
Well, I'm not judging everything around the 40-yard dash, as, you know, because, you know, it doesn't equate to football. You know, football is about stop and go and being explosive. And, you know, any guy, you know, I feel like guys can line up, they can teach themselves, they can have coaches to teach them how to run a 40. I want to see a guy that can drop his hips, come out of his cut, not take too many steps, and not catch the ball with his body, willing to extend his body and being able to elevate. So those are some of the things I look for in a wide receiver.
Jerry, this is Mike again. You know, you're a guy who obviously can look at a guy and understand exactly what you just brought up. How successful are you in your own mental little game of watching a guy in the college level, predicting their success at the NFL level? Because obviously GMs aren't that great at it. I'm a Jeff fan, so I know we're not great at it. How successful are you? How many times do you see a guy and say, this guy's the one that's going to make it, Victor Cruz or whatever, and another guy, like, they're going to draft this guy in the first round, but he's never going to cut it?
Well, you know, I think that's what made Bill Walsh so special, because he was able to see that. And I think with me, because I play the game, there are certain tendencies that I look for, and I can tell when a guy is going to be able to take it to the next level, be successful, and also he's going to work hard. I think the most important thing is, you know, when you first come in, not to get complacent and feel like, hey, look, I'm the best to step onto this football field. You sit back, you watch the veterans, how they approach the game, then you try to emulate those guys, follow in their footsteps, and just work hard every day to develop your skill.
Now, Jerry, obviously any sports fan in the world knows you, and they know your career, they know they could rattle off your records and the rest, and, you know, your Hall of Fame speech and the rest. But what's interesting about you as a guest is, you know, we announced that you're coming on the show. My mother and mother-in-law, first, independently of each other.
I know you're not going to say that. Go. I'm going to let you go ahead and finish that, but I think I know where you're going here. Okay, go ahead.
That's the guy from Dancing with the Stars, not the best wide receiver of all time, greatest football player.
I mean, when you agreed to go on that show, did you have any idea that, A, that your fame could even grow anymore, but that it would garner that kind of attention?
Guys, you know what? I decided to do the show, but I didn't know everything that came with it, because you really have to work hard, you know, because you're dancing in front of, like, millions of people, and as a competitor, as a guy who played football, I think the right way, you know, by always giving 100%, I tried to pour that into Dancing with the Stars, because I wanted to win that ugly trophy. I wanted that trophy. But, you know, I came in second. But, man, I cannot believe the people that followed, you know, that followed me on Dancing with the Stars, that supported me. And when I see moms now, I don't know if they know me from football or if they know me from Dancing with the Stars. So I run through airports. If moms, if they shimmy at me, I shimmy back at them, and I just keep going.
That's right. I'm telling you, my mother, every year when they announce her new people, she'll say, "Do you know so-and-so? Do you know so-and-so? They're professional athletes. Are they going to be any good? Should I root for them?" Like, you know, it's funny. It's amazing. You guys can reinvent yourselves.
Yeah, but the demographic of people that you meet, you know, so someone that might not have known about me in football, they know about me from Dancing with the Stars. If they don't know me from Dancing with the Stars, the big break NFL. So many different things, and I've been blessed over the years. And, you know, to be able to, after playing the game for over 20 years, make that transition and do other things and still being able to touch people, you know, and giving them an opportunity to get up close and personal to you, I think it's fantastic.
Yeah, I mean, and that's why I want to end the conversation with what you've done after your career is over. I mean, you're involved in several different foundations in and around the Bay Area, involved with the Foundation for Chiropractic Progress. Now, talk a little bit about what you're doing foundation-wise right now.
Well, you know, chiropractic, I think that's the reason why I was able to play the game for 20 years. You know, you have to be, you know, mentally you have to keep yourself involved, but also physically, you know, getting adjusted every week, keeping my body in alignment, and just putting the word out there to people that, you know, this is something that they need to do to take care of their body. And also my foundation, the 127 Foundation, we support the March of Dimes, the Big Brothers, Big Sisters. And I also do this one with Steve Young, you know, 8 to 80, and we do a lot of work for the 49er Academy over in Palo Alto. So, you know, I feel like I'm blessed, and I have, you know, the opportunity to really just touch a lot of lives.
Yeah, I mean, just to touch on the chiropractic foundation you're a part of, I mean, I have a daughter who's got some sensory issues, and we looked at a whole bunch of different type of alternative medicines, and one of the things, and she's only 2.5, and she goes to a chiropractor twice a week, and we've noticed noticeable differences since we started bringing her, calming her down. You know, it's amazing, and it's something that people, you kind of look at chiropractic and you think maybe it's just like voodoo doctor, but it's amazing what it's doing for my daughter, and you know, you're a testament for what it did for your career.
Yeah, and so many of the chiropractors, they thank me every time they see me. They say thank you for, you know, bringing so much attention to chiropractic and letting people know that, you know, they need to take care of themselves. And, you know, like I said, I played the game for over 20 years, and I think that's the reason why I was always able to be productive on the football field.
Well, Jerry, I mean, you're well known as being a gentleman, and I think you showed it here tonight, and we really appreciate your time calling in on a Wednesday night. I know you're a busy guy. Can't thank you enough, Jerry, and maybe they'll have some sort of reunion show on Dancing the Stars, and my mom will say, hey, my son talked to that guy.
Hey, be sure to tell your mom that somewhere probably down the road, you know, doing this new Dancing with the Stars, she might see me surface or something like that, okay? I might be doing the cha-cha, I might be doing the paso doble, I don't know, but I'll be having fun no matter what.
That's fantastic. Well, thank you again. That's the great Jerry Rice right there. And, you know, obviously, check him out. Check out his foundation. We're going to post all the stuff on our website. But, I mean, I think obviously his skill sets on the football field were fantastic. But you look at, I mean, he comes across as such a good guy that it's impossible not to like him. I don't care what kind of fan you are. That's why
moms and housewives love them, and that's why football fans and sports fans love them.
No, I mean, it's just, we're all old enough here to remember his playing career. And I'll tell you the stuff I remember from him and a guy like Barry Sanders, a guy like Emmitt Smith, was all the great plays they made, all the touchdowns they scored, all those things. And all this newfangled stuff you see with spiking the ball and all this stuff. These guys just scored 9 million touchdowns. They just handed the ball to the ref.
Yeah, I mean, right.
It was just
I know you
so cool.
That.
He's such a gentleman. It was so great to talk to him. That was as cool as it gets, isn't it?
Yeah, that was a little bit surreal.
Yeah.
Slightly surreal. I mean, and the idea that when I started talking, I mean, how many times has he probably been asked that question about Dancing with the Stars?
Yeah.
Part of me didn't want to ask it. But then I'm like, I have to.
You do.
I have
for
to.
For your mom.
For my mother.
And your mother-in-law.
It opens him up to like a completely different set of, completely different world.
I'm not lying to you. The first thing my mother said, so I told my father about it last night. We're going to have Jerry Rice on, and I could hear my mom in the background. I asked him about Dancing with Stars. That's the guy from Dancing with Stars. I text my mother-in-law today. She said, who are you having on tonight? I said, we have Jerry Rice. The guy from Dancing with the Stars? Not the greatest football player.
Right.
Judged by his peers, the greatest football player in the history of the NFL.
Yeah.
The guy from Dancing with the Stars.
Yeah.
But only he could pull something like, I mean, Emmitt Smith pulled it off to an extent, but like Jerry Rice, as great as Emmitt Smith is, Jerry Rice is in another level of icon status.
I mean,
he just pulls it off. It's amazing.
You know,
and what a nice guy.
It was just that's what's so cool about it. You know what I mean? Is we've had so many good guests on the show that are gentlemen and speak to us like we're on their level. You know what I mean? They're just so gentlemanly with us. But this is a guy, like you said, he's just on a different tier. You talk about Emmitt Smith, and you can talk about Jim Brown, Barry Sanders, Gale Sayers, all these other guys that were phenomenal. When you talk wideouts,
yeah,
in the National Football League,
right,
it's Jerry Rice, and then you start talking about Art Monk and those other guys like an hour later.
Yeah, yeah, right.
No disrespect to those guys.
No, but it's just a different thing.
Yeah,
yeah,
he's just
exactly
on that tier all by himself.
It's amazing, and what's funny is, and we don't have to mention names, but there's been plenty of guests nowhere near the level of Jerry Rice,
right,
that have completely blown off when we've tried to ask them
absolutely
to come on the show. You know, you guys do a podcast, this and that. And Jerry Rice not only just agreed to it, but gave a fantastic interview,
yeah,
and couldn't have been the bigger gentleman. So then it's not, to me, I never will give one of those people a pass that acts like a real jerk to us.
Right.
And it's completely rude. I understand if they can't do it or they don't want to do it. But to be like downright rude to our producer, Maddie, who's out there trying to book us guests, and then you see this, it's like, you know what, this is Jerry Rice took the time out to talk to a newer group of fans that might not listen to him.
Yeah.
And you know, so I'll never give those guys a pass.
No, and you know what? There's a couple of coaches who are no longer in the NCAA tournament who I've emailed who just don't care.
Yeah, that's
and
right.
Then Jerry Rice, he caught, what, 3 million balls? He just called in and just talked with us like a couple buddies.
Just like, awesome. Yeah, like we're
yeah
just rattling, just catching up on old times.
Yeah.
All right, we need to take a break.
I can't wait.
Quick break. We'll come back. We're going to get to wrap up some NFL
talk.
Where
do we go from here? Where do we go from
here? I think
here
we just end out with about 45 minutes to say what, and you and I could just... Say what? It's like, yeah, we just talked to Jerry Wright. Say what? All right, we'll be right back with the Tri-State Sports Cast.
Bud Light presents Real Men of Genius.
Real Men of Genius.
Today we salute you, Mr. Really, Really, Really Bad Dancer.
Mr. Really, Really, Really Bad Dancer.
Arms swinging, knees bending, head bobbing, to no particular rhythm. You're either dancing or you have fleas.
Call me a doctor.
As soon as you hit the dance floor, the taunts begin. Is that all you got, playa? Unfortunately, yes, that's all you got.
Pour it on now.
Who's in the house? Some guy who can't dance. That's who's in the house.
You're a star.
So crack open an ice cold Bud Light, Mr. Happy Feet, because you really put the oogie in boogie.
Mr. Really, really, really bad dancer.
Ooh, okay. All right, we're back. Tri-State Sports Guys. Again, if you missed the keyword, I'm going to give it to you one more time because I'm a nice guy.
One more.
Because Jerry Rice was so nice, I feel like I need to be nice.
Go ahead.
The keyword to call for the 10% off the Motto Landscaping, Tanaka.
Tanaka.
Tanaka. Simple word.
Yeah.
Great. A lot of A's in it.
Greatest big league pitcher of all time.
That's it.
With
the
a
savior.
0-0 record.
The savior. So give him a call. Again, 203-286-8062 or at themottolawn.com. So I just wanted to wrap up our NFL talk a little bit. And And, again, I wanted to talk a little bit about Buffalo and just to put a bow on that. I mean, the passing of Ralph Wilson, he had said while he's alive that team will never leave Buffalo. Although they were a team that, you know, there's plenty of other towns that have been courting the Buffalo Bills to come, including Toronto, who's a major market. People talk about Toronto, but it's like, I think it's the number one market in Canada. It's one of the bigger markets in North America. Tony, I mean, maybe I'll point it to you. I mean, do you see now he wants this team to be sold after he passed?
Yeah.
Somebody's going to buy it. Do you see, I mean, in 5 years, the Bills playing in another city? What do you think? I can't imagine it, but
I would hope not. I mean, that would literally be – I would give up on sports. I lost my basketball team. I lost my football team. I don't know what I would do. I read an interesting article today. I guess they said that his they said that nothing will happen for at least 2 years. That's when his estate will be, you know, all that stuff will still be going on. But the interesting fact is that they have a lease with the stadium until, I think, like 2020.
Oh, do they?
So they can't – or it's like 2025. And if they leave before 2025, they owe like $300 million. So whoever's going to do that, I think there's like one clause where they can get out in 20 – they have at least till 2025 – in 2020, they have an option to get out for like $48 million. So if that's the case, then I think, you know, obviously somebody would do that.
It sounds crazy, but think about if you're L.A. and you get a group of crazy investors together in L.A., they're going to get some sort of crazy, your own network or whatever, Los Angeles Bills network.
In a heartbeat.
$300 million would be a drop in the bucket. I mean, the Dodgers sold for $2
billion. I mean,
if that's the thing and they got to be like, I'll buy that thing out, it's $300 million,
and
to get a franchise here in L.A. or something like that.
There's probably only probably one or two places that could do that. L.A. is
probably
LA obviously is, one of them.
Is the one to go to.
And that's what you've heard that talk for years. Like, they've always been hinting at getting, you know, moving that team there. But, oh, man, I don't know.
That would be a devastating thing. I mean, look, Buffalo is a – as a down-on-their-luck city as it is.
And they're dedicated,
oh, my God, yeah.
You want to know what's amazing to me, seriously, about all the Buffalo talk, is you have two sports teams, and I don't want to upset Tony, but neither one of them's ever won the Super Bowl, the Stanley Cup, and yet, even when they stink, people go to the games.
Well, right.
It's a great two-sport city, and I don't know why there's always this talk of, a few years ago, it was like moving the Sabres to Hamilton, Ontario, and it was moving the Sabres to Seattle, and it was all these things. And now the Ralph Wilson passes away, and all this stuff comes up again. Like, we treat it as though it's this outpost.
Well, because
I don't get it.
I'll tell you why. It's because the success of franchises is no longer about ticket sales. It's about the market you could sell to TV.
Okay.
And I think it's such a small media market that I think that hurts them. So they could sell out games, and that's fine. But as the NFL, they want a team that's going to be some draw on the national stage. And a team in L.A. is going to have a draw, a much bigger draw on the national stage. It sucks to say it, but
– but aren't there other teams – I guess that's kind of my point – that you could move more readily?
Jacksonville.
Jacksonville
doesn't even take
– I mean, Atlanta is one of the worst sports cities on the planet.
Yeah.
They have Braves playoff games that aren't sold out. They have Falcons games a few years ago before they got good that people aren't even
at
these games.
And the Hawks were an exciting team over the last –
And so you have a city like Buffalo, where it's obviously cold and it can be – the winters are friggin' awful, but the people show up with friggin' sled dogs if they have to go to a Sabres or a Bills game, you know? And when the NBA was there years ago, wasn't it?
Yeah,
and they always did well. They finally moved them, I think, where? To Milwaukee or something?
Yeah, I think Milwaukee.
Or something like that.
Yeah.
They've done well at everything. Even the Buffalo Bulls football games are sold out. I mean, I'm being serious. So it's like – like you mentioned them being down on their luck and everything about the city being kind of tough. Why would you move the football team? I mean, how much do you want to disenfranchise one American city?
Just annex upstate New York to Canada.
I don't understand it.
It looks like they have some kind of long-term lease with Western New York, Erie County, and New York State. It says it runs through 2023, and if they left before that, they'd have a $400 million penalty. Except there's one exception. In 2020, they have a buyout option for $28.4 million. So,
well, the thing is, for any kind of move to happen, it's going to be a three-year building-up process.
Yeah.
So 2020 is not that far away. I mean, we're in 2014, 2015 season coming up.
you know, they could start putting money together and funding together. I would hate to see them because I mean, it's a good rivalry of the East, you know.
Yeah.
That see games up in Buffalo, it's exciting. I mean, it would be awful to see it, especially having come from a guy who created the AFL. I mean, since his passing, and I had heard those stories, but they're all being rehashed about when the AFL started, and he started it with a $25,000 investment or whatever it was, and other teams were ready to fold. He was throwing in money of his own money back in the late 50s, early 60s to keep the league afloat. One of the good guys, like one of the, you know, George Halas's or the Maras and these guys who like got that the game was so much bigger than their own team and just a money grab type thing. And, those owners are few and far between at this point in any sport.
Now it's worth, what is it, $850
million? $850 million.
Yeah. I mean, so it's a sad thing. And, obviously you have something that's so polarizing, something dominating the news, like all the trouble Jim Irsay got into. And then you have somebody like this pass away. It's what Jim Irsay did is just a mistake. Now you have something sad. It's like,
for such a league
that's so successful.
Yeah,
to have two stories like this come down so polar opposite from one another in one week, it's weird.
A good point from one of our listeners is what would happen if they did go out west? What would happen with the alignment of the league? You obviously couldn't keep them in the East. You'd have to some team would have to get gobbled up, whether it's maybe probably Baltimore is the closest AFC city, would have to get gobbled up into the AFC East, and you have to – I mean, the realignment issues alone for the divisions would be crazy. I mean, would the NFL want to – break up the Baltimore Raven Pittsburgh Steeler rivalry just to accommodate a team out west? They might, because the money might be there.
We got to repost Neil's realignment article. Remember that one from months back?
He still gets hits every day.
Yeah, and have him reconfigure.
People telling him what an idiot he is, but they
he's laid up with a knee.
He's got some time on his hands. He's got to wake up tomorrow like, dude, I had this crazy dream that Mike and Dan sat and talked to Jerry Rice last night. It's going to be crazy. But we got to just finish up our NFL talk with
Jared Allen.
Well, I'm going to talk with both of our teams. We talked about Tony's team out there in Buffalo. We got to talk a little bit about Jared Allen staying within division. Now, I thought it was like a done deal he was going to Seattle. Maybe I just didn't read. I just saw headlines last week that he was heading to Seattle. Maybe he was just visiting with Seattle. Now he's going to the Bears. 4 years, $32 million. There's it basically guaranteed 15.5, and there's a buyout after 3 years. So he the 4 years means nothing in the NFL. We know that because they could just cut him at any point. But is that going to be how much worse is that they let Jared Allen go, and we both thought he's got a lot left in the tank, and they let him go, and he's going to stay. He's going to go to the Bears. Could it be any worse?
Well, Green Bay.
Would it be
Green Bay? Would be much worse.
I immediately thought, like, what is worse? Jared Allen going to the Bears or Darrelle Revis going to the Pats? I think Jared Allen's even worse because
it's an older rivalry.
Older rivalry. Plus, people in New York already hated, you know, and all Jet fans proved that we were phony because we were ready. I mean, I hated Darrelle Revis for the way he treated the Jets and the wrist and bad mouthed him on the way out, but I was ready to welcome him with open arms if he wanted to come back, and then he spurns us again. So I think that there was nobody in Minnesota like hates Jared Allen.
No, and you know
and
what?
You're not going to hate him if he's fighting for the Bears.
Yeah, I mean, I'm on Twitter a little bit more now, so I saw some of the feedback from that, and it's like, you know, I reposted his thank you that he, you know, sent to the fans, I mean, for whatever that's worth. I'm not mad at the guy. Because the Vikings are such a miserable, awful organization that they never make the right moves. And I don't know how long they're going to keep Spielman in the GM seat there, but how you don't re-sign Jared Allen, who's a fan favorite for a club going nowhere, and you pay Everson Griffin the kind of money you could have put aside to re-sign Jared Allen makes zero sense. The Bears are way more relevant. I wish him nothing but the best. He was him and AP, my favorite Vikings by like a landslide.
Yeah.
So I wish him the best, and it kind of sucks to say that because I can't stand the Bears.
Yeah.
But I hope he gets a Super Bowl or does something good for himself. You know what
I
mean?
Yeah, he's such an easy guy to root for.
You know what I mean?
So such things you got to root for. So you had that storyline, which is like, how are you going to replace a guy like Jared Allen?
You just
can't. And then you look at the Jets, they go out and sign Michael Vick, which I had said back when the season ended, the guy they should go out and get is Michael Vick. Said on
couldn't
the show.
Wait to ask you about this. Go ahead.
And I think it's the perfect fit, to be honest with you, because what amazes me is Jet fans have been crying – for years, since Mark Sanchez days. They don't bring in a veteran to really compete with them.
Right.
They don't bring in a veteran to really compete with them. And then they bring in a veteran to really compete with Geno Smith, and they say, well, that just shows that you have no confidence in him, and you're just saying, you know, I'm a quarterback. And you got, and I'm just going to say it at this point, idiots like me, Francesca, saying, oh, that's just, the key to this league is having a franchise quarterback. When you have two quarterbacks, you have no quarterback. Oh, is that really it? Of course. Dude, if it was that easy, if they had a franchise quarterback, they would have gotten it. It's not like the Jets preferred to have two quarterbacks and not a franchise quarterback.
Yeah.
It's not like they preferred it.
No.
They tried to get one in Mark Sanchez. He didn't pan out. They tried to hit lightning in a bottle in the second round with Geno Smith. Jury's still out on him. I don't see him being a franchise quarterback. But now it's like that's a bad – like this was their plan. A grand plan all along was to have two quarterbacks competing. That's just stupid. That's a stupid comment by a lazy person. You know it.
I do know
it. I mean, of course you'd rather have Tom Brady. It's not like the Jets are like, no, we'd rather have these two mobile quarterbacks with question marks than Tom Brady. That's our plan.
Yeah.
This is stupid.
Here's what I want to know. I want to know how much value you put in Rex Ryan's comment that Geno is still the guy. He's the guy that's going to be tough to beat out. I want to know if you think that's just he's kind of grandstanding, standing by his guy, because he is. He's loyal to his players.
I think it was the perfect thing to say in the media. I think that
you think he means
whatever,
it?
No, I don't think he means it, but I think it's funny that Rex Ryan gets criticized for being overly honest, but then in this point, he was clearly, to me, making a PC-type comment to make. The best case scenario is you have these two guys come out there lighting the world on fire in the preseason, and it's a real competition.
Yeah.
So the only way to do that is to say, well, Mike Vick's got to come in there and really prove himself, because anybody that's going to beat out Geno Smith's going to have a hell of a preseason. It's the best way to say it. So, but then he gets criticized for that. The guy can't win with what he says. That's the typical every other coach would say that. I mean, what is he supposed to say? We think Geno Smith sucks?
Well, no, I mean, obviously he can't say that. I just was curious if you think he meant it in any way. Because
I
didn't think there was any chance he could mean that.
I don't think he could possibly mean it.
Because I would say, and maybe you'll correct me, but I would say the percentage chance that Geno Smith starts opening day, if everybody's healthy, is maybe 10%.
I was going to say between 10 and 20%.
You know what I mean? So...
there's no way his skill sets right now are better than Michael Vick.
No, it's impossible. And, you know, the other thing is I love coaches, and we've had this discussion about Rex. I like Rex. You know what I mean? I'm not a big fan of the, like, big flamboyant comments that he'll make, like, you know, we're better than the Patriots. And you're like, come on. You know what I mean? Wait a sec. But I do like the fact that he stands by his guys. He doesn't sell his players down the river. You know what I mean? Guy has a bad game. He'll kind of eat the blame for him.
Uh-huh.
You know what I mean? And how you dislike a coach like that is utterly beyond me. Like, I get it if you think he talks too much, but as someone who's not a New York Jets fan, I look at it like, hey, I don't care what he talks about. I mean, as long as you don't make stupid comments, which are, we're going to be better than the Patriots, like a couple years ago, whatever the hell he said about him at the time, it's like, you know, yeah, we're just going to go out there, we'll beat the Seahawks this year. Like, you know, you're like, come on, Rex, calm down.
Well, the thing is, like, he didn't come out and say, Michael Vick's our number two quarterback. He came out and said, if Michael Vick's going to beat him, he's going to have a hell of a camp.
Right.
To beat him, which is a perfect thing to say. You couldn't have, if you're a PR person, you couldn't, to light a fire under,
even
you know,
though it's not true.
To light, even though it's not true.
Yeah.
Like, none of the things these coaches say are true. So it doesn't matter.
Right.
But the one time that he, you know, tells his little white lie to get, lights a fire under Michael Vick, lights a fire under Geno Smith, it kills two birds with one stone that way, because it's saying, like, Michael Vick, even though anyone with two eyes and knows anything about football knows you're much better than Geno Smith and knows that you're better. He's saying you got to work your ass off to come learn this offense, even though he also played for this coordinator. I mean, the fit is perfect. And you have the guys that want to say this guy should just burn in hell for what he did to these dogs. And there's no way to even excuse anything that he did to those dogs. But, I mean, the guy went to jail, lost $100 million. I mean, at some point, people have to get assimilated back into society. I mean, what do they want him to do? Just sweep floors for the rest of his life? Like, that's how the penal system works. You pay your debt to society.
Yeah.
He did it.
No, but I think I'm not going to try to put words in people's mouth. My issue with him is, I believe had he not been caught,
he would still be doing it.
And that's my problem.
That's like,
and I'm not going to get into this like ASPCA thing. I just think if he didn't get caught, this isn't a guy who went to jail for like a triple repeat Dewey or something like that, and he gets out and he goes, you know what, I stopped drinking, I cleaned up my life, and he's cool. where you don't worry about them. This guy is like, you know what, dude? If they didn't catch you, like, hanging pit bulls by their head,
he didn't
from
think
post,
there's anything wrong. Oh, without a doubt.
You know what I mean? And I don't even want to hear about, like, the cultural aspect of it. Like, you know what I mean?
Yeah, no.
This is what Michael Vick's familiar with. Because that's, you know that's wrong,
you know
if,
it's wrong
if you have an adult head on your shoulders. If you asked a five-year-old, they would tell you that's wrong.
100%.
That's what I think people's issue is. If he didn't get caught, he's still hanging dogs down
in Georgia.
You can
say that about almost anybody who's sitting in jail right now.
Yeah.
A guy selling drugs. They could either come out and continue to sell drugs, or they could say, what the hell was I doing?
Right.
I learned my lesson spending a couple years in jail. It's the guy that does whatever. It's Plaxico Burress. Would have continued, if he didn't shoot himself in the leg, he would have continued to carry loaded weapons in the clubs.
Yeah, who was it? Stallworth a few years ago? He ran somebody over and killed him. And people, that's what's weird about society. People have kind of forgiven
him. Well, the guy wasn't using the crosswalk. So.
Yeah, but
I mean,
this guy was hanging dogs and killing dogs
and
fighting dogs. And he's persona non grata, I think he is, but I would take him on the Vikings, which
but
makes
isn't
me
this what
a D-bag.
What you want the penal system to do? If not, then why don't we say anybody does any heinous act, it's life in jail. Just say it's life in jail.
I'm in.
I mean, anytime you do anything that I decide is heinous,
you're
it's just
deciding?
Life in jail. Yeah, me. Whoever wants to be on Twitter and wants to say decide it. I mean, you go to jail as a punishment for what you did,
right.
and the goal in all of it is you'll never do that again. And
right.
I think he's proven he's not going to do that again. Now, he could be running this underground thing now. I would bet pretty good money he's not doing it anymore. Isn't that the purpose of the penal system in America?
Yeah, but you know as well as I do, there's still people sitting there. And, you know,
I don't think it has to prove a lesson in the ground. I'm talking
no,
about
no, no.
Michael Vick.
But there's still people sitting there that are going to continue to crucify this guy. That's all 100%. I'm saying. I think he has a right to play. All I'm saying is I think people don't like him because of the fact that they think he'd still be doing it.
Yeah.
And it's such a cowardly thing to do. You know what I mean? It's worse than a lot of things. When you do something to a dog or like a little kid who can't defend himself, then you become the guy who's not like beating up an adult and going to jail for battery.
Yeah.
Like you're picking on a kid or a pet
or
something that can't do anything about
it. Horrible.
And that's why
I'm not saying I like the guy.
No, I know. But like I said, if the Vikings picked him up, I'd be thrilled. Because they have a bunch of idiots playing quarterback there with the greatest running back like in the last 20 years in the backfield.
Yeah.
And then they just don't re-sign Jared Allen. So if Michael Vick went there, I'd be like, this is friggin' sweet.
Yeah.
Like,
I'm
we
not
actually
buy
have a guy.
I'm not going to buy a Michael Vick jersey.
Not.
I'm not going to buy one for my daughters. But,
no.
I mean, the guy paid his debt to society. That's what we believe in as Americans, don't we? I mean,
now that we've established that, we can move on.
Yeah.
We just figured that out. I mean,
we just broke it down.
If anybody,
we became smarter by talking to Jerry Rice. Then we just break things down.
If anybody wanted to have cultural things like defined for them tonight and they're listening,
yeah, 347-637-2306. Any question, we'll just answer it. You want to talk about whatever you want to talk about. So is there anything else NFL wise? I mean, Mark Sanchez going to?
I don't care.
Yeah,
you care?
The only thing I care about is I do like the guy. I've always liked him. I think that is a system he can succeed in. I honestly do. He'll never beat out Nick Foles. There's nothing like that. But if something were to happen to Nick Foles and he's thrust into and he wins out the backup job and becomes the backup, I think you could see him succeed in that offense. I really do.
All right,
not succeed like Nick Foles does, but I think he could sit there. The best thing that could happen to him is he gets some sort of two-game audition at some point because Nick Foles goes down for a couple games.
Right.
And he goes out there and proves that, hey, I could play here again. Like,
yeah.
Look what I could do here. I think that would help him, and he can go get a starting job somewhere.
Yeah, I
do.
You know what?
So.
I don't think he's a lost cause. A lot of people do. I don't think he is ever going to beat Tom Brady. But I do think he proved with the Jets, you give him a good defense, you give him a running game, you give him some little parts around him, he can win. The thing I want to know is this. I was watching some stuff the other day on the NFL Network. I want to know who Houston drafts, number one, and who you would take. Who are they going to draft and who you would take with the first, or what you would do with it? Would you trade it?
Personally,
you
I would
said
trade
that last
it.
Week on it.
I would trade
if
it.
If you didn't, who would you take and who do you think they take?
Oh, boy. I mean... See, here's my issue with it. I'm not a Jadeveon Clowney guy. I think that guy's got bust written all over.
Right.
Because of this guy was just able to dominate with his overall just athletic ability and his size. I'm not a Johnny Manziel fan.
He's a bum.
I think that guy's got bust written all over him. And the more people you hear, experts that know more than me about it and watching film and talk about the decision making he makes, pre-read snaps and all the things that actually make you a quarterback in the NFL. He doesn't do exceptionally well. So that kind of leaves Bortles as the guy that I would probably go with. I mean, I don't know how much you put into the pro day of Bridgewater.
That's
probably not much. It's one bad day. I mean, we've seen enough of Bridgewater to know. But I mean, I guess if I've got the first pick and I have a need at quarterback, it'd be Bortles.
Really?
Yeah, I mean, who would you pick? I mean, are you going to pick a lineman with the first round pick or first
no.
pick overall? Sir?
Well, you know what?
You can't pick Watkins first overall.
First of all, something's telling me that they're going to take Clowney.
Yeah, so I get that sense too.
Something
when they
in my mind
the with Mario Williams.
When they look at it and they go, you know what? If he pans out, if he's half as good as these so-called experts,
and they think maybe J.J. Watt could,
and they put him and Watt next to each other,
and he's
going to
say,
legit.
"This is how you play."
You know how much I love Taj Boyd, and I've even said I think you can get him in the third or fourth round, which I think is the right move. But you know, if I had to pick a quarterback there out of those guys, I would take Teddy Bridgewater.
You would
over Bortles. I think he had a more impressive college career. I think he's got a huge arm. I think he's a smart kid.
I always worry about the Bortles type guys that kind of come out. As a non-college football fan, kind of came out of nowhere. Like, this guy, oh, my God.
Yeah.
It's
plus
like the Blaine Gabbert, where all of a sudden everybody's like, well,
yeah.
Blaine Gabbert's got to be a top 10 pick because
yeah.
look at it, what he did.
And he's playing in the American Athletic Conference, which is far from the SEC or the Pac-12 or whatever. But I think, you know, if you're looking for, like, a legitimate guy who could step in and be great right away, I'll give you two guys. I'll give you Khalil Mack from Buffalo, and I'll give you Anthony Barr from UCLA. I think
everybody
those two legitimate guys. Khalil Mack is just a freak of nature, speed. He's smart. Every single guy you listen to that talks to this kid says he's brilliant. I think he's going to be a legit middle linebacker for a long time to come.
And what do you think about Kevin Pierre-Louis? Where's he going? He going
well,
to crack the sixth round? I mean, he was coming as a guy borderline draftable, undraftable. Does
well,
the,
his combine
puts him,
probably
put
moves
him, in,
him up two rounds. At least.
Gotta put him on fifth, sixth round, right?
I would say
that's a guy that needed a combine and came out and just
yeah.
I mean, if you were the bubble kind of guy, that's what the combine's for.
Yeah, and the astonishing thing about that is, here's a kid playing in the ACC, which is good football.
Yeah,
you know what I mean. And he played exceptionally well.
All
and
ACC,
he's got, as he showed,
freshman defensive player of the year.
Right, he showed at the combine. He showed if you watch him play, he's got speed. He's got the what do you call it? The instincts to get to plays. I like that kid. I
Did
think you
just
know,
forget the word instincts?
I just forgot the word instincts. if he was a sixth rounder, I think he could move up probably to the third or fourth round, judging by his combine that he had.
All right, let's go. We got a couple callers waiting patiently on hold here at the Tucci Lumber Hotline. We're going to go out to line number one. You're on with the Tri-State Sports Guys. Who's this?
It's Nick from Norwalk.
Nick from Norwalk. How we doing, my brother?
What's going on, guys? There was two things I wanted to talk about. I tuned in a little late when you guys were talking doing your World Series predictions there. And I remember a few weeks ago on one of your Facebook posts, we were talking about the Yankees, the over and under wins there. Remember that,
yeah.
Mike?
Yeah, absolutely.
Well,
yep.
Yeah, you know, now that spring training's kind of, you know, ending and all that, I'm trying to, you know, think of the number where they're going to, you know, that magic number they're going to hit. And, you know, seems to me it looks like around 90 wins, and I was wondering what you were, what you guys were thinking about that.
Yeah, I mean, I actually heard Cliff Floyd on the Fan today, and he predicted 90 plus wins for him. I don't see it. I just think they have to. There's too many of these guys that have injury issues, injury pasts that have to all stay healthy. And you can go basically, and we talked, one of the things that we said, the two guys that I'm most confident are going to stay healthy or are going to put up numbers are Soriano and Beltran, who are two old guys. I feel like both of those guys are fine. I see them being down in the low 80s, to be honest with you. I worry about their lineup. I think that their bullpen will be a strength, even though a lot of people are worried about their bullpen. But I worry that all these things in their rotation have to all of a sudden come together. You gotta have CC reinvent himself, which is not easy for anybody to do. You need Tanaka to come out and hit the ground running. You've got Kuroda, who's got to show us that he's 38, but his second half was just an aberration, and he's really a strong pitcher. And Pineda, who hasn't pitched in a couple years, needs to come in and say, oh, yeah, I am the guy that you traded for. It seems to me like there's too many question marks there.
I was for Phelps for getting the fifth spot, but, I mean, they had all that invested in Pineda. Might as well give him the shot, you know? I mean, you know, I think Phelps is, from what I hear, Phelps and Warren are going to be long men. Warren's going to get the garbage time. Phelps, what they hope to do with Phelps is put him in, make him maybe as an important, you know, give him an important role in the bullpen, kind of like Phil Hughes in 2009, come out and, you know, if Sean Kelly maybe struggles down the road, maybe he can be a guy come in and get four outs for the Yankees in a big spot. And I guess Nuno is going to, you know, stay stretched out in Scranton and be the come up and be a spot starter in case of injury or whatnot. But I got to say, watching the last 2 weeks of spring training there, the starting rotation looked good. I mean, CeCe pitched 7 innings of no-hit ball. I know it's spring training, whatever, but and he looked pretty good. But, you know, Pineda only gave up his first runs his last outing. Tanaka's been, you know, pretty much what everybody's expected, you know. And biggest question mark for me is obviously going to be Jeter. I mean, Brendan Ryan starting the season on the DL, so I guess they got two roster spots they're going to fill, and apparently it's going to be Nunez and maybe Dean Anna, because apparently that Solarte isn't on the 40-man, so they got to find a reason to bump somebody off the 40-man to keep him, who besides Cervelli is batting close to, like, 480 in, you know, the spring, which is, you know, again, spring training, but it's some crazy numbers, I mean, putting up there. And I think Cervelli ended spring training close to 500 with, like, 4 home runs. And he got named to the backup catcher's role, and there was a lot of rumors rumbling around that he was going to get traded. And I don't think they should trade him. McCann's got injury-ish history, you know. I know last year he was injured, you know. One thing with a catcher, you want a solid backup. So, you know, I'm all for keeping Cervelli around this year.
Yeah, I mean, I'm a fan of Cervelli. I kind of like him as a backup catcher, but I said before, I give him a couple more wins than my co-host Mike. I give him like 83, 84 wins. I don't see it in that division. You got some teams there that are going to beat each other up a little bit. I think Mike and I agree we like Boston and Tampa towards the top of that division. But we appreciate your call, Nick, and stay in touch with us, buddy. Keep following us on Facebook, pal. We appreciate it.
All right, guys. Later.
Thanks, bud.
All right, that's Nick from Norwalk, and he runs a couple Yankee fan pages, which actually they are very good just to follow. I mean, they do have great insight for, like, a Facebook fan page to tell you about injuries and tell you about, you know, what the manager's thinking. So if you're a diehard Yankee fan, I don't know off the top of my head, but I will post them on our site to follow it, some sort of New York Yankees fan page. It's got about 10,000 likes on it on Facebook, so it's doing very well. So you got to check that out. But
he had a good-to-share article up that I did read.
Yeah?
A week or two ago. Yeah. Some good stuff on there. You had an article about the Sharon and something else with the Yankees, but not being a Yankee fan, I don't remember it.
Sorry,
I can't remember the word instinct.
At this
point
of the calendar year, I am just so amped up about baseball. And when I get to say, and I thought my whole life, I thought you were like the same type baseball fan I am, but you're really not. You're really a college football, college basketball, hockey guy.
Well, I would say, as big a baseball fan as anyone in the last 5-6 years, it's dissipated.
Can I talk to you a little bit about the Cubbies then?
You can go. You want to talk about Javier Baez?
I want to talk about Javier Baez.
Okay.
Because this guy, I mean, if you've watched any, the baseball nerd that I am, I mean, after I get my daughters to sleep, my wife always goes to sleep before me, I watch the MLB Network. And now, and I usually watch it to try to find, like, you know, they have the MLB Today or whatever, tonight, but they'll have minor league games starting at 10 o'clock. You know, it's always on tape delay. But I've seen a bunch of Cubs games. I've seen this guy, Javier Baez, and you watch him. I mean, this guy, you want to talk about, like, prolific power. I mean, this guy doesn't have, like, you know, these balls aren't scraping the back of the fence. This guy's hitting 500-foot home runs. And it's just amazing. And you look at him and you say they're playing him all around the infield a little bit. It's probably going to slot into second base. So when you look at, like, the vision, and they brought in Epstein, what was it, after the 2011 season?
Yeah.
So he's had him for 2 years, and it's just like slow development. And he didn't bring in Baez. Baez was there. He inherited mm-hmm. him. But he brings in Olt,
yep.
right, who now all of a sudden, 2 years ago, he was a can't-miss guy. I mean, the Rangers were penciling him in, finding a way. They had him in the outfield because they have to get his bat in the lineup after he had his big season. He had 30 home runs or whatever and like 400 at-bats. They had to get him in the lineup. He had these eye issues. Something was wrong. He had blurred vision or something crazy. So he had a very down year last year. They get him as part of the Garza deal. So you got him. And all of a sudden, he starts hitting home runs in spring training. You look at him, 25-year-old guy. So he's going to make the opening day roster. I got to imagine he's going to beat out Valbuena. So you're going to look at him at third base. You got Starlin Castro at shortstop. I got issues with part of Starlin Castro's game. I mean, when he came burst on the scene, this guy's just going to hit 220 hits a season, that type of player. He's got that kind of, like, the people that criticize Cano, you could have the same criticisms
Absolutely.
About Castro, but
Absolutely.
He ain't Cano.
No, he's not.
Cano. But he's still very good short. I mean, a lot of teams would love to have a young shortstop like Starlin Castro. Then you could put Baez there at second base. And then you have Anthony Rizzo, who, to me, still has trouble hitting lefties, but he's got all the potential in the world.
I love him.
Absolutely.
He got Wellington Castillo behind the plate, another good young catcher who's there. I mean, he's gonna they got rid of Kataris today, and and Baker won the backup job. But clearly, there's not a lot of teams that have a young catcher that you could say, "Here's your catcher," right?
Yep.
They get the kid Junior Lake, who we've been hearing about. This kid's got like 5 or 6 home runs in spring training. You wonder if he's going to be any good, but he looks like he's a player. I've seen him hit.
He came up last year. He did well. And
yeah.
I forget who it was in your fantasy league that actually text messaged me about him, and I said, "Yeah, he's worth the pickup." And then he did well.
Brian Baker.
But I think it was Cowboy, actually.
Oh, was it?
It might have been Cowboy or Coach Ireland or somebody that messaged me or something. But I love him, dude. And I was watching him play Sunday after KU got knocked out. I told you I watched Darnell McDonald drop that ball in left field. He's a converted shortstop. He's got all the athleticism you would want. He's got a quick swing. He's got good speed. All the reasons you mentioned about the infield are reasons I like the Cubs' chances to do some good things this year. I don't think they're going to be good at all.
No,
but the pitching.
I think Samardzija could be a legitimate. He's so frustrating because you'll watch him and he has one blow up inning.
Yeah.
But you know who was like that a few years ago? It was Matt Latos. He was a guy when he was out in San Diego, you'd watch him, you're like, this guy's a front of the line starter. And then you'd watch him and he'd be so frustrating because he'd have one blow up inning and he would get pissed off and fly off the handle, and he would be losing for the game. And I get the same sense with Samardzija. He'll cruise through 4 innings, and then they'll put a 4 spot up against him, and you're like, you know, what happened to Jeff Samardzija?
Well,
but he's got stuff.
Well, he's got great stuff, but Hall of Famer Fergie Jenkins was in the booth last season doing a 7th inning stretch, the song there that Harry Carey used to do. And it was Samardzija's start, and he mentioned about Samardzija that he thinks he pitches to the wind at Wrigley.
Oh, fuck.
And Jenkins and Rick, I've heard Rick Sutcliffe say the same thing, both said they used to wake up in the morning, look at the wind, and just not care. Like, they didn't care because, you know, Jenkins had great stuff, Sutcliffe had very good stuff. But ever since he said that about Samardzija, you watch him, and in some of those conditions at Wrigley that are a little bit hitterish, he just gets so far down in the zone that he can't throw strikes.
Yeah.
That's a concern when you're telling me that this is the ace of the staff. That he's a guy that if it's a little bit windy or breezy or maybe, God forbid, a little bit chilly off of Lake Michigan, he can't throw the ball over the plate. Wouldn't that concern you? And then you look at everything else and, you know, Wood had and all those things and some good parts in the bullpen, but there's nothing you can rely on. So you look at the Cubs and you go, you know what, if some of these young guys contribute, they'll score. They're not stopping anyone. They're not going to stop anyone. And you know it as well as I do, especially facing the Reds, facing the Cardinals, facing the Pirates.
Yeah, yeah.
Will they stop it?
I'm not saying this year. But
no,
you've
I know.
You've got an infield that's all under the age of, what, 26 years old? Got Junior Lake. The kid they drafted in the first round last year, this kid Bryant, who led them.
Out of San Diego.
Yeah, had 37 home runs or whatever in college.
He hits bombs.
Just drops bombs, and he's college ready, so that means he's not far away.
Right.
I mean, this kid's going to be up in the major leagues, like, next year. They're probably going to have to put him in a corner outfield spot, I would assume. He's a third baseman by trade, but put him in a corner outfield spot. Now, we talked about Castillo. Then you get Samardzija. Then you've got these other pieces. Like, can you get – if Darwin Barney could show you that he goes back to being a 275 hitter, very good defensive player. They've moved him around a little bit to show that he could play – showcase he could play shortstop. Could you move him for something, an arm or whatever? Could they find some arms around? Like, if – and the Cubs have shown in the past that they could spend money. They're not spending money now. They got a payroll less than the Mets, I believe. It's like in the mid-80s. But – they're poised to be in the position where if they want to go out and just throw a ton of money at a John Lester next year, they're saying he's going to have a deal before spring training. I mean, before spring training ends, it hasn't happened yet. Are they going to be able to throw money at it? Are they going to be able to add a guy at a trade deadline type thing, an arm, and be able to fill out a rotation? And I don't know the rest of their arms down in the minor leagues. You know, you always hear about arms for the Cubs. I don't know. They got the guy Arrieta that they got from Baltimore.
Yeah.
He's been a mess, but he's got crazy stuff, but he's a mess.
Well, you're not packaging Barney. Is that what you're saying? Package him for some kind of what, like a third or fourth starter?
Yeah, package Barney in an arm for somebody who could be a...
And you know what's funny about that is I'm a huge Darwin Barney fan.
Yeah.
Love everything about the way he plays. Had a down year with the bat last year.
And because they tinkered with the swing.
Yeah, you know, he's not a guy you look at and go, you know, he's a threat. But I think you could get a team, like, in contention, especially an American League team that's going, you know what, we're going to bat him ninth. We need him to hit 240 for us, play that kind of defense, because he is Gold Glove caliber at second base. But I don't know if you get if you're trading him, let's say, to the Tigers in the middle of a pennant race, I mean, who the hell are you getting for him from a pennant race team? You might get a prospect or something.
Yeah, so I'm saying a prospect, because they're not ready, but I'm just saying.
But,
this is a team that's going to be ready in 16 2017. Can they turn Darwin Barney at the trade deadline if Jurickson Profar can't come back and Texas Rangers are ready to make a move? Do they have an arm down in double A that they can throw to Darwin Barney to plug that hole up because they think they're a second baseman away of making a run? It could happen.
It'd be great, but you know what?
You never – I'm just saying, like, they're not – and you're talking about Theo Epstein here, who is, like, on the precipice of getting killed in Chicago because it hasn't happened fast enough. But you see that – you could actually see for the first time since probably the late 90s with the Cubs where it's like they are actually starting having some pieces together where the Cubs could be good.
Well, I mean, there was a great article a few weeks ago from the Chicago Tribune about the benchmark when the club was really heading downhill was the minute they signed Kosuke Fukudome. And this guy literally he laid out this great article that was comical. But I'm looking at it going, you know what? They literally they flew him in by the cover of night as though he was a beetle or something. Like, you know,
didn't he like
big
carried
deal.
Out onto the field?
It was unbelievable, dude. And then with that kind of last name, the way it's spelled, you could just imagine the signs that were held up out in the bleacher seats.
Oh yeah.
F-U-K, Domi, you know. But that was really those things were done before Epstein got there.
Yeah.
You have to be patient as a Cubs fan, like infinitely patient. I like Epstein. I have faith in him. I have confidence. I would just love to have coffee with him and be like, dude, just explain to me. Just tell me when
there's something.
When are we going to get that big splash? When are we going to get an ace?
So you said early in the show you're not a huge fan of Tanaka.
No.
So they were the ones that were going to say we're going to match any offer, and we don't know. Maybe they did match the New York offer, and he still decided to go to New York. Would you have been happy if they threw $175 million at Tanaka?
No, and I said it at the time on the show. I said, you know, I didn't want any part of him, especially at that price, because I think what Epstein is doing is saying, you know what, give me some time and do something. But he started cutting fat off of the payroll last year, you know, and he started making some deals, getting rid of guys. You know, he ships all these guys out. He's starting to make a deal where you look at it and go, you know what, they're going to really spend at some point.
1 year, that salary is going to go from 85 to 125.
I don't think, and I think that might be on the low end. You know what I mean? I think when you look at the Ricketts family, the amount of money that they have, they've said from the get-go, we're here to spend money, we're here to win. We're not here to just own the Cubs. We're here to bring you that World Series that's eluded you since 1908. But there's people that, like you said, they want to kill Epstein. I don't get it because you go, who are you going to bring in? Jed Hoyer? I mean, who are you going to go get that you bring in and go, okay, this is the guy now?
Yeah, now all of a sudden.
So, you know, you got to have patience. Price. They're not going to be good. If they win 70 games this year, it's a miracle. It really is. I mean, that's the point you're at. But if you see some strides made by these young kids, it would be really helpful.
If you could see all of a sudden Rizzo become a 290 and 30 hitter at first base, you see Mike Alt come out and hit 20 home runs at third base, and you see Starlin Castro be another 300 hitter, 200 whatever hits, you see Junior Lake come up and make progress, you see Wellington Castillo, and you see Samardzija kind of solidify himself with 14-15 wins, and then you get a taste of Baez at some point in the middle of the season. That's enough. Even if you're winning 70 games, that's enough. And you have a great September.
Well, it has to be. I mean, to your point, that's exactly what this year has to be, is the guys that we fans expect production from, some of the guys you mentioned. I love Rizzo, and I've explained that to people that have asked me about him. I love his swing. I like his defense at first. I think he's a team-first guy. He's willing to pull the ball on the ground, get runners over. He's not like a selfish D-bag. He'll do the things necessary for the Cubs to win. And then at some point...
He played for the Italian national team.
Absolutely. At some point in August or probably after the September call-ups, you start seeing some of these guys and getting a taste for what the team could be in 2015, 16, 17. That's the kind of year you got to hope for. But there are Cub fans, like there are Met fans, going, they could win 90 games. And I don't know on what earth you're living.
Yeah, no, not with that pitching
but
staff.
But they're not, you just can't. You can't, not with that pitching staff in that park, not in any park, but especially at Wrigley where the ball starts jumping. You're just not going to win.
No,
I mean, they just, you know, you'd like to see Samardzija become that guy. Excuse me.
Well, they got a young arm, too, in the Garza trade. I can't remember the guy's name.
Yeah, I know.
That
was
the cornerstone of the deal.
Yeah.
It was him. And Olt was almost like a throw-in.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean.
He had a bomb the other day. Olt hit an absolute bomb.
I love the guy.
Bat speed going 300 miles an hour, and he ripped this ball into the seat so fast you couldn't see it.
I mean, you watch him and Baez, like, jumped off the screen at you in spring training. To me, like, guys are like, and I don't. I mean, I know both of the guys. I know who they were just from fantasy, like you know these names. But they were guys that like jumped off. And Lake didn't really jump off other than you see his stats, and they're fantastic. But those guys, you see balls hit that far. It's like Matt Adams. You look at Matt Adams, and you're like, this guy is a different type of player.
Yeah, I mean, the thing with Lake that I like is the speed of everything he does. He hustles, which is why I like him way more than Castro already. He doesn't dog anything. He's got great bat speed. He's a good outfielder. And what they say is he's actually a better shortstop than he is an outfielder.
They have three shortstops, you know, that any team would want when they have Baez, Castro,
yeah,
and
there's some hope, but we'll see. We'll see how it goes.
All right. Well, our producer, Janet, is telling us we got 90 seconds left. So we got to thank the great Jerry Rice for joining us. Great work by our producer, Maddie Scully, for hooking that up. Got to thank our sponsors there, Tucci Lumber and D'Amato Lawn, for everything they do. Next week, we'll be getting into like the Mets will be undefeated at that point.
Absolutely.
So we'll be just talking about the Mets going on a run.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the countdown, like they'll have the little magic number out of the hat. Magic number. The Yankees will be out of it, and
yep,
we'll be talking about all that. So check us out next week. We'll be breaking down the Final Four. Check us out, as always, on TriStateSportsGuys.com, Facebook.com/TriStateSportsGuys. We're creeping up on 1,000 likes. We got to get to there this week.
I'm going to be really thrilled when we do.
It's going to be great. Balloons will come down. And then at @Tristate_Sports on Twitter. Thanks a lot. We'll see you next week.